It being 10 o'clock, we'll call the Property Tax and Local Government Finance Division meeting to order for Monday, March 20th. With that, we do have a quorum. We'll move the approval of the minutes. Representative Rarick, would you move the minutes? Representative Rarick moves the minutes. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Thank you. The minutes are adopted. Next, we'll be moving on to item number three, House File 2412. Representative Draskowski moves House File 2412 to be laid over for possible inclusion. Chair Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have a DE5 amendment, Mr. Chair. I move the adoption of the DE5 amendment. And I could talk about that, Mr. Chair, if that would be helpful.
Why don't you proceed?
The DE5, Mr. Chair and members, the initial bill that I did put out repeals the authority for special service districts, and this considerably narrows it. The original intention was to get a bill introduced, and this is actually the content, the DE5 amendment, of what we would like to do to be able to better define the authority under which these fees can be offered and collected within municipalities in the state.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Any questions on the DE5 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
The amendment is adopted. And to your bill.
Well, Mr. Chair, we have talked in earlier meetings about different situations in the state where we have municipalities that may be operating either outside of the law in their ability to tax or provide fees within their jurisdiction. And in some places, it is very, very gray. So what this bill attempts to do is to bring more definition to the authority for jurisdictions to institute and carry out these special service districts and bring more clarity to that. So I have some testifiers that will help with better describe the bill and the need for it.
Very good. And the first testifier?
Mr. Nelson and Mr. Franklin is here. Ms. Brill. I don't have my agenda, Mr. Chair, so I apologize.
Welcome to the Tax Committee. If you would state your name and who you represent for the record, we would appreciate it.
My name is Toby Brill. I'm here representing myself and the property owners in the Warehouse District of downtown Minneapolis.
Thank you. Proceed.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for this chance to testify today. My name is Toby Brill, and I manage two businesses at 4th Street North and 1st Avenue North within my two historic buildings in the Minneapolis Warehouse District. I personally maintain both buildings and the sidewalks. I'm here on behalf of myself and a number of small businesses and their commercial and historic properties in Minneapolis, most located outside the core downtown area, to ask this legislature to hold the city and the public-private partnership with which it partners accountable to its taxpaying constituents, but more importantly, to the laws of the state of Minnesota. Why am I here? This has to do with the city's enhanced services, namely greenery, safety, and cleanliness in the downtown improvement district. The city began this program in 2008 after the legislature enacted a statute permitting it to designate special services districts and levy assessments to provide the extra services. These are basic services, which, as the city claims, are enhanced and are paid for via an assessment. But in reality, they are not provided in any meaningful way to our properties, and to the extent they are, quite simply add no benefit to my property nor to those of the other small historic buildings and their land. And what's more, the DID services have categorically failed, at least for our neighborhood. For example, what could be more important than the enhanced safety? Well, crime statistics in the warehouse district are not getting any better, and in some categories they are much worse. This, despite the high fees being unfairly assessed. I'm not here to argue that a DID or even the specific goals that the city is trying to accomplish are without merit, and to the extent that they have merit, they benefit the public generally and not the property owners that pay the charge. Rather, I'm here on behalf of my fellow small businesses to argue that they're being unfairly and perhaps illegally charged these fees instead of how they should be assessed, if at all, by property taxes. What is the financing mechanism? Well known to you is that a city must show a property-specific benefit if it may impose an assessment on the property. And these fees are not small change. The few historic properties in the warehouse district are bearing $1 million of a $6 million annual program. We understand why big business likes the DID fees. The vast majority of the services are provided to the large businesses and their properties, and therefore they get a massive subsidy to pay for the services from small businesses who simply can't afford the fees. It's interesting that every 4 years I have paid effectively 5 years of taxes. That 25% differential is the DID fees assessed. But I receive no benefit at my property for these extra payments. We try to work with the city, but at every step, this has failed. But last year, the Supreme Court of Minnesota finally weighed in on these services in the St. Paul Church's case that you will hear more about from Peter Nelson. From our perspective, the court spoke loud and clear. If cities want to charge for these types of services, services which benefit the public generally and not the property owners that pay the charges, then the city must fund the districts or services via a property tax. If the city alleges it's an assessment, then the city must be able to show the benefits of the properties so assessed. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would stand for any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Brill. Members, questions of Ms. Brill? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank
Mr.
you.
Chair, who would you like to call next?
I'm wondering, Mr. Chair, if it would help maybe if Mr. Michael would just walk us through the bill, if he could just talk about the specifics of it, and then we could have Mr. Nelson speak.
Certainly. Mr. Michael's on his way here. Welcome, Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, members of the division, Joel Michael from House Research. I'll just quickly go through the DE5 amendment. All of these changes are amendments to the Special Service District statute that allows imposition of service charges on properties in those districts to provide additional government services in the district above the level that's provided elsewhere in the city. Section 1 redefines the basis for those service charges, which under current law are based on the cost of furnishing those services, to either be based on the net tax capacity, so it would be an ad valorem style levy, or based on the classic special assessment benefit test, where you measure the value of the benefits that are received by the property. Section 2 amends the objections that property owners can make to essentially the formation of a special service district to be consistent with that change. It adds the authority to object if you're an exempt property, which exempt properties are not subject to these service charges, so that would be a basis for excluding that property from the service district. Sections 3 and 4 amend the appeal provisions for property owners who are appealing the imposition of a special service charge by a special service district so that it's consistent with the, you know, the new basis that the bill provides for assessing those service charges. And that essentially is the change. So basically what this does is to change the standard from a cost standard to either an ad valorem basis or a benefit test.
Thank you, Mr. Michael. Questions from members? Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Michael, when I see the word improvement, I tend to think of a capital improvement as opposed to a benefit or a service. Is that term more broadly inclusive as it's used in this part of the statute?
Mr. Michael.
In general, the word improvement would refer to a capital improvement, which is the most typical way that a special assessment is imposed. So in other words, a city, for example, might put in curb and gutter or sewer and water, and the standard theory is that that makes the property that's served by that improvement more valuable, and so it's appropriate for the city to recoup that amount. What these special service districts do is a combination. They can do improvements, but they can also provide day-to-day, you know, operating services. You know, and it's unclear to me exactly how one would determine benefit under the local improvement, you know, assessment kind of theory. So chances are it would default back to, if they want to fund operating services, it would default back to an ad valorem style levy. But it's not, I can't say that definitively. I think arguments could be made that, you know, ongoing delivery of services could enhance the value of property. That, you know, that's sort of an appraisal question.
Thank you, Mr. Michael. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Michael, I mean, the current language in law under lines 1.5 to 1.9 provides for a variety of ways of proportioning the costs based on the service directly rendered or classification of types of properties to which the service is furnished or any other equitable basis. And I have just a small little Main Street commercial area that went through a lot of work, I don't know, probably 10 years ago, to create a special service district, maybe it wasn't that long ago, to do snow removal in front of all these little Main Street stores instead of having each shopkeeper having to do their own and then figure out how to get the snow away from the sidewalk if it's a big snowy winter so that people don't have to climb over the Billy Goat Mountains from their car to get into the shop. And they have loved having the business association go out for a common bid, getting a cheaper rate than if they each did it individually. But I think their assessment is based like on street frontage rather than on the net tax capacity, which really wouldn't necessarily relate to the benefit of how much snow you have to remove or that sort of thing. So I'm a little worried that we are really narrowing this to a way that wouldn't be workable for many of the ways that these have served portions of communities. And how would you see that fitting within this new, they'd have to do it on net tax capacity, or I suppose that improvement language, it taking away snow doesn't feel like an improvement. Feels like maintenance.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, I think I'm not an expert on special assessment law, but I've read a number of those cases. I think we're in a little bit of uncharted territory here. that in the sense that almost all of the litigation in the special assessment area has related to capital improvements. I think, you know, it's certainly possible that the city could argue that we're providing a benefit to you that's equal to some measure of the market value of those services, and that it's appropriate to, on a benefit basis, charge for that, as opposed what the statute now says is just to presume if the cost is what you assess, whereas the special assessment law focuses on, it's like two sides of the equation. It's like on the one side, it's how much did it cost? The other side of the equation is what's the value to the property owner? And what this change does, I mean, like I said, in the special assessment law, the focus has always been on capital improvements, and that's been essentially proved by appraisers coming and saying, yeah, the market value of your property is higher because of the presence of this improvement. I don't know, in theory, though, the city could argue that, look, you benefited from snow removal service, and so it's appropriate to recoup that benefit, not just based on our cost, but what the benefit is to you. I don't know. I think that's the question that it raises.
Thank you. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I look forward to learning more and hearing from the testifiers.
Thank you. Other questions from members? Representative Youakim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. By focusing on the other side of the equation, could you end up with a case where the business owner is actually paying more because their tax capacity is higher versus what the true cost of the service is, instead of looking at the true cost and dividing it out equally?
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Youakim, there's no question that if it changes from a cost to a ad valorem basis, that's going to change the distribution of who pays for it. You can think about the 30-story office building versus the small shop. And so it's not going to at all be, if the services are financed with an ad valorem levy, it's not going to be based on cost or benefit. It's going to be based on the value, the tax capacity of the property. And depending upon the type of district, the kind of example Representative Loeffler had, you know, where maybe they're homogeneous properties where they're all small storefronts, it's not going to have much of an impact. But it would be a big impact where there's wide variation in the tax capacity of the properties.
Thank you, Representative Youakim. Questions from other members? Seeing none, then we'll move on to the next testifier. And Mr. Nelson, if you'd state your full name and who you represent for the record, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you. My name is Peter Nelson, and I represent Center of the American Experiment.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The bill before you today aims to conform the Special Service District statute to a recent ruling by the Minnesota Supreme Court. This ruling, in my opinion, provides a very clear statement that the charges that are made against these properties are actually taxes and should therefore be subject to the constitutional limitations on taxation. I want to do a little bit of review on what's a tax versus what's a fee and where cities get their authority to impose these fees and taxes. Their ability to raise revenue comes from both the taxing power and the police power. The taxing power is inherent in state sovereignty. Governments need the taxing power to exist. This is a very broad power, but the Minnesota Constitution does impose three important limits. The taxing power can only be used to raise funds for public purposes. The taxing power must be uniform, applied uniformly, and certain entities are exempt from taxation. The taxing power also includes the power to levy special assessments. The Constitution allows local governments to levy special assessments for local improvements that provide direct benefits to property owners. The assessment cannot exceed the benefit that's provided to the property, and that's measured based on the increase in value of the property. The city may also collect revenue by collecting regulatory service fees under their police powers. The police power authorizes cities to pass regulations for the purpose of preserving public health, safety, and morals, or abating public nuisances, and the city may also charge regulatory service fee in order to defray this cost. This regulatory service fee can only be used to defray the cost of this regulation. Now, raising taxes is generally not a popular policy position for a lot of local governments or around here. To minimize tax increases, cities have begun raising revenue more and more through fees. Characterizing something as a fee provides a huge benefit. One, of course, you don't have to raise your property taxes, and unlike a tax, it doesn't have to be strictly uniform or match the benefit received. The courts have applied a reasonableness standard to these fees, which gives cities broad leeway in how they establish these fees. And the final thing is that a fee can be applied to all properties, including nonprofits. So seeing all these benefits, the city of St. Paul made a shift in how it funded street maintenance in 2003. They began using their right-of-way maintenance fee to fund all road maintenance. In making this move, city officials frankly admitted, this is a quote from one of their reports on their fee, the changes in the right-of-way assessment since 2003 were all a result of policymaker wishes to control the growth of property taxes. There's a serious problem with this approach. A city can't just call something a fee to avoid constitutional limitations that would apply if it were a tax, when it's actually a tax. But determining when a revenue-raising measure is a fee or a tax can apparently be quite challenging. The St. Paul right-of-way fee went to fund things that were clearly public purposes. For example, snow plowing and traffic lights. Everyone, of course, benefits from unobstructed roads and safe intersections. Nonetheless, a district court judge and an appellate court judge both ruled that this was an appropriate fee under the guise of the police power. And when I read this opinion, I was really astonished, because the reasoning in the opinion just wasn't there. There was very little reasoning in the opinion. And then I went on and I read another appellate court decision, 110 Wyman. This is a court decision that was based on the Minneapolis Downtown Improvement District. Again, we had an appellate opinion that approved the Minneapolis Downtown Improvement District fee with very little reasoning, very little analysis on why this is a fee versus a tax. And when I read those opinions, I decided that it was time for Center of the American Experiment to get involved in this St. Paul case. And we filed a friend of the court brief to try to make clear, try to draw some clear distinctions between what is a tax and what is a fee within the case law. It was a great case to define this issue, because these churches were in a very sympathetic position. These churches, one of these churches was charged a $15,000 fee for their right-of-way maintenance. By comparison, the UBS Plaza was charged about a $5,000 fee. This was completely unfair. But courts have said, well, you know, cities get a lot of leeway because of it needs to be reasonable. At the end of the day, the Supreme Court ruled against the city at a unanimous 6-0 decision. And in doing so, they gave us a very clear statement on what is a tax versus what is a fee. So according to the court, many of the services funded through the right-of-way assessment benefit the general public in precisely the same manner as they benefit the properties assessed. They used a standard that basically focused on what is the benefit to the public. If it's benefiting the public, then we're going to look at it as a tax. If it's defraying the cost of regulation, we're going to look at it as a fee. And in the case before us, the bill before us right now, basically makes that distinction in our statute. Instead of applying a reasonableness standard to these downtown improvement district fees, we are going to apply really what the Supreme Court said previously and say, okay, if this is revenue that's going to fund something that benefits the public in general, we're going to treat it as a tax. And as a tax, you can we're going to either allow an ad valorem, traditional ad valorem approach, or we're going to allow you to charge a special assessment and prove that you benefited that property. And that's what this bill aims to do. And in the case of these downtown improvement districts, it will improve the accountability and oversight of these taxes and fees, of these fees. And in the case of, we already heard earlier that in the case of maybe a Main Street operation, this might not actually make that much of a change, as the values have a pretty similar, if the values of property are pretty similar. But in the case of, say, St. Paul right now, they are having to make some changes. The churches are finally being treated fairly. And This is an effort to try to apply that in this downtown improvement district and these special service districts in the same way as right now the City of St. Paul is working to adjust their right-of-way maintenance fee. And with that, I'll stand for questions.
Mr. Nelson, question I would have as maybe an example what your opinion is, if this would be the correct application of a fee. A lot of cities have a uniform waste collection, refuse collection, or recycling. Many cities in the past have just made that a part of their general levy. Many cities have decided that that is maybe a little unfair in that a four-member household in a $600,000 home is generating no more refuse than a four-member family in a home that's half the value. So some cities have moved to a fee basis for that refuse collection. Would that be a characterization where you think that's appropriate so that somebody isn't paying twice as much as someone else for basically the same service?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that would be appropriate. The Supreme Court opinion clearly identified if the service is providing a direct benefit, if it's a direct resource that they're consuming, like, say, your electric utility bill, that's a direct service that you're consuming as a property owner. Refuse collection, another direct service that you, where you're receiving a benefit from for that specific property. So that would be appropriate.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nelson, help me out here a little bit. St. Paul doesn't even have any special service districts, first of all, and I understand you're trying to make this link between their right-of-way assessment and these special service districts, and I'm failing to find the link between the two. What I'm reading here is that service districts are at the request of the businesses. So in your first 5 minutes or so of your presentation about a tax versus a fee, it's all well and good, but if that's being brought forward by the business community at their request and simply using the city's taxing authority in which to collect that service charge, I guess I fail to see the link between the St. Paul right-of-way assessment case and tying that to something to which doesn't seem to match up with what's taking place in these services, which are throughout the state of Minnesota and on a broader scale would be referred to as business improvement districts around the country and around the world. So if you could just maybe take a few extra minutes to describe how you're trying to make that linkage between the two would be helpful.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. Mr. Nelson.
Representative Carlson, Mr. Chair. The link is that both the right-of-way fee in St. Paul and the special improvement districts in Minneapolis and elsewhere are providing services that benefit the public generally. They both do the same thing. In St. Paul, the right-of-way maintenance fee paid for snow plowing. In Minneapolis, this special district pays for enhanced snow plowing. They both pay for things that are funding the public generally. And so, and in both cases, they weren't relying on their taxing power to do this. They're relying on their police power. And in that sense, because they're relying on their police power, they were able to get away with charging fees that they deemed reasonable. And yes, these businesses in there is a distinction between St. Paul and Minneapolis. St. Paul charged this fee to the entire city. And in Minneapolis and these other areas, they've narrowed that boundary down. But just by narrowing that boundary, I don't believe gives you the power to just to call this something under your police power. It's still services that benefit the public generally. No one, everyone benefits from clean sidewalks. Everyone benefits from better security, from the security cameras that are placed out there. And so because this is a general benefit, you have to get that authority from the taxing power. And the taxing power has limits. And this piece of legislation tries to conform these special districts to the taxing power and move away from the police power.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Representative Carlson.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Nelson. So, Mr. Chair, so I think what's missing from your explanation, though, is that these are enhancements that are above and beyond which is the base level of service to which a city or municipality provides. Very unlike what we're seeing with the St. Paul case. So there's very distinct differences between these two, and I think you're trying to find some common ground, and I just don't think it exists.
Mr. Nelson.
President Carlson, Mr. Chair. Actually, in the case of St. Paul, they did have a downtown district that paid more than
established under 428A. Thank you, Mr. Chair, but not established under 428A, not as a service district.
Mr. Nelson.
It's a completely different statute.
Mr. Chair, President Carlson, it is a completely different statute. Absolutely. But at the end of the day, despite the fact that they're enhanced services, the enhancements are enhancements that benefit the public generally. These are bitey enhancements that the business owners come forward and say, we want these things, but they are things that benefit the public generally. Every person that comes downtown to work and drives into downtown to work is benefited by these things. Every person that comes downtown to shop is benefited by all of these things. These are not fees that go to defray the cost of regulation, of the regulation of these businesses. And it is that one key characteristic that these services enhance the city for the public generally. That is the key distinction.
Representative Carlson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. It's my understanding that these enhancements were brought forth as a way in which to compete with their commercial area, not necessarily as a means to benefit the overall public good, but services that they felt would help them compete within a downtown or whatever the area is which is defined. So that is which is set forth by the businesses, not dictated by the municipality.
Mr. Nelson?
It's not the city saying what services they need to provide. It's the businesses saying what services they would like to see as an enhancement to the base level of service to which the city is already providing.
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, the city at the end of the day approves the fee, and the fee is applied to all of the businesses in the district, whether you like it or not. And in that sense, this is very much a tax. These smaller businesses don't like this fee. They don't believe that they're paying for a benefit they're receiving, and they're not receiving a benefit from these fees that goes to the property. And in that sense, this is very much a tax because it's enforced on everybody. That's what a tax is. It's an enforced charge to provide a service that benefits the public generally. And that's despite the fact that businesses like a lot of these businesses like it and have asked for it, you still have to go through our traditional processes when it comes to taxing people. That just because a lot of people like it doesn't mean you get to avoid the constitutional limitations that are put in place to protect people like the small businesses.
And we have another question from Representative Yu Kim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nelson, at least we're getting down to the distinction. Tell me, yes or no, is there a distinction between a special improvement district and a special service district?
Mr. Nelson.
And how they're constructed.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we're talking about a special service district, mm-hmm. which can allow for enhanced services, and it can allow for improvements. So we're talking about one and the same thing. It's just there's two different ways, under this amendment, there's two different ways to pay for it. If it's an improvement to the property, you can prove a benefit. And if you prove a benefit to that property, you can charge an assessment against that property individually. Otherwise, you have to go through the traditional tax structure, the ad valorem tax structure.
Follow-up, Representative Yu King.
Mr. Chair, I'm just bringing that up because you mentioned the tort case is actually in a special improvement district that's imposed by the city, not on a special service district where the businesses have actually asked for the special assessment. And what I think we're losing in all this is what these are really used for in our towns. And it's not just Minneapolis or St. Paul. Hopkins doesn't have one. St. Louis Park has six. There's places all over Minnesota that have these districts. And what this is, let's say A small main street wants to stand out, wants to be more welcoming. They decide to want flower boxes or banners or special snow removal to make it easier for their customers to get to them. 25% of the businesses in that district have to bring this forward and agree on it. But if 35% of the businesses in the district say, no, we don't want it, then it doesn't go into effect. These are the businesses coming to the city to ask for this special service, and it is a special service. I would have to disagree with Mr. Nelson, that directly is related to their businesses, whether it be special snow removal, whether it be landscaping or flower boxes or planters or hanging banners or tree lighting. It's things, or even let's say they were doing, here's a good example of infrastructure versus extra infrastructure. Let's say you're doing a total reconstruct on a main street or a county highway going through which would be your downtown. And the businesses say, look, the traffic is completely out of control. They're going way too fast. We want some traffic calming measures. Can you engineer some? One of those traffic calming measures might be putting a safe median in between or some landscaping to slow down the traffic in that area, because they're like, hey, you know, we want people to be able to park in front of our businesses without worrying about getting hit by a car going 55 miles an hour, because we have 55 here and they're actually going 60. So the city goes, well, you know, we can't really afford to add that into the project, but we will if we can do a special taxing district just to recoup that portion of it. So these are things that the city, that the businesses have come to the city and asked for, which is completely different than a special improvement district, which is what the court case in St. Paul was on, where the city decides what's best for the businesses. These are the businesses deciding what's best for the businesses and going to the city for some help. So I just wanted to make that clarification. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Yu Kim. Representative Barr has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure who to direct this to, but I've heard the 25% of businesses need to agree, or 25% of the businesses can petition, but I heard Representative Yu Kim say that 35% could go the other way. So can I just get some clarity around what percent of businesses need to petition and then how it actually gets approved, if it is truly a majority, or how do these services, I don't know who to direct it to, I don't know if it's the bill author or staff research or...
I think maybe Mr. Clement might be prepared to answer that question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barr, under Section 428A.08, that's where the 25% number comes from, and what that section essentially says is that owners of 25% or more of the land area of the property that would be subject to the service charges in the special service district. And there's some other language here. They would have to file a petition requesting a public hearing on the proposed action with the city clerk. As far as the 35% number goes, I'm kind of looking at this on the fly here. If 35% or more of the land area, if the owners of 35% or more of the land area in the district subject to the service charge, file an objection, the special service district ordinance would not become effective, and that's under section 428A.09 subdivision 2, the requirements for veto. There may be some other provisions in this chapter relating to objections, etc., but those are I can at least confirm the details of those two numbers for the committee.
So, Mr. Clemens, what I heard you say then is 35% of the land area in the service district, not necessarily 35% of the property identifications within the district.
So the statute says owners of 35% or more of the land area.
Okay, so you could have one owner with 35% of the land area could potentially obstruct that. Representative Barr.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. So saying it a different way, though, that an owner with 25% of the property area could petition to have a special district, So I'm just trying to tie it back to our earlier testifier, I believe it was Tony Boyle, who said that out of $6 million, they're getting the special fee of $1 million to their property. So a larger property in that district could potentially petition to have that service district, which could negatively impact another large majority of property owners. That's what I was just trying to get at, how this gets approved and who has the input. So thank you. I think that answered my question.
Thank you, Representative Barr. And Mr. Clemens, for clarity, did it apply to the petitioner's 25% land area, or was that property owners in that circumstance?
Mr. Chair, yes. So the as far as filing a petition to create a special service district, owners of 25% or more of the land area of property that would be subject to the service charges would have to file that petition.
Okay, thank you for that clarification. Questions from other members? Representative Joachim?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just so I understand, too, does anything in this statute require, even if the business is petitioned, for the city to actually do it? So does it doesn't, it, the city could still say no?
Mr. Clemens, I think I recall some past experience in my own circumstance where, no, you could actually invoke that.
All right.
Because the city still has to take out the bonds or figure out the mechanism, so I think the city can still say, if the city council deems it unfair, even with the 25-35, the city council could still say, yeah, no, we're just not going to do that. We don't have the money up front to do the costs.
Mr. Clemens.
Mr. Chair, Representative Joachim, I would have to look at the specifics of the approval process to answer that question. I can certainly do that and get back to you and the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Clemens. And Representative Joachim, I recall some certain circumstances where sewer and water is petitioned by 25% of the area of landowners and not necessarily 25% of the owners. Oftentimes, in municipal situations, the city is anxious to go ahead and extend service into an area to develop their community. Any other questions, Representative Barr?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So tying on to Representative Joachim's question, and I just want to make sure that she's asking the same question. So 25% owners of the property to petition, what actually does it take to get that approved to actually create the service district? Does it go to a vote, or is it just when they do the bond authority, or how does that happen?
Representative Barr, we determined we needed a little more research.
Okay, so I just want to
answer. And members, we need to kind of keep moving here. Any other questions of Mr. Nelson? Mr. Clemens?
Mr. Chair, I phoned a friend sitting in the audience here. The city council has to approve the district. So
thank you. All right. Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Our next testifier, Chair Drazkowski, who would you like to call to the table?
That's all I have, Mr. Chair. There's others I think that want to testify. Okay. I would bring members' attention to some of the language in current law on 1.5, 1.8, and 1.9. So it says that are reasonably related or to a reasonable classification of the types of premises or on any other equitable basis. So that's the very, very big latitude that is given in these areas right now that the bill really attempts to narrow down.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members from the audience, anyone else would like to testify on behalf of this bill? I see somebody else. Please step forward and come to the chair here, and please state your name and who you represent for the record, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Steve Kramer. I'm the president and CEO of the Minneapolis Downtown Council and Downtown Improvement District.
Welcome, Mr. Kramer.
Heard about this morning already. Mr. Chairman and members, I think there's been a fair amount of confusion this morning, so I'll do my best to try to offer some points of clarity. And as you have been, as you've already discussed, special service districts under the requirements of 428A are initiated, approved, and controlled by the private sector. Commercial property owners are voluntarily taxing themselves via service charges meeting the petitioning requirements, which have been discussed, of 428A. Nonprofit, including churches, residential, and governmental properties are exempt from these service charges. The basis under the amendment from Representative Drazkowski, if ad valorem property tax system were used, would bring back in residential properties. That's just one example. So under 428A, we're talking about commercial properties only. Now, these service charges are devoted to activities which are enhancements to basic city services, enhancements to basic city services, which improve the quality, standard, and consistency of experience in a defined geographic area. For us in downtown Minneapolis, that experience and that standardization of experience revolves around improving the quality of the safety experience, the cleanliness of downtown, and also the physical environment through greening initiatives. As others have said, the use of service charges, according to 428A, must be reasonably related to the special services provided. So our methodology brings into account not only linear square footage, as one of the representatives talked about, Representative Loeffler in her district, but also gross business building area, so the density of a project. And we also have two zones of service provision based on the intensity of pedestrian use in our downtown area. And in your green folder, there's a map that displays that two-district breakout. So we have a very specific methodology that tries to be as fair as possible based on this reasonably related to service provision test in the 428 statute. Basic city services must continue. Basic city services must continue within the geography of a district and cannot be supplanted. 428A requires service charges may not be imposed to finance a special service if the service is ordinarily provided by the city from its general fund revenues, unless the service is provided in the district at an increased or enhanced level. Commercial property ratepayers are in charge of determining the use of service charges and monitoring and evaluating the quality of the enhanced services they determine are needed within their district boundary. And yes, it's true that these service charges are collected through the city through the property tax system for cost efficiency and compliance sake. That's certainly true. Every year, each affected commercial property owner has two avenues of appeal: appeal of their individual service charge and appeal of the district's budget for that year. And every 5 years, at least in Minneapolis, the downtown district, DID, must be renewed as a whole. And I would just note, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and Representative Drazkowski, for the last 2 years in Minneapolis, commercial property owners representing less than 1% of the DID service charges have filed appeals of the budget, and no individual appeals have been filed. Now, DID is entering its 10th year, and by acclamation has been a success. It's improved the quality of life in downtown Minneapolis. And I have in your packet, I have a one-page summary of the DID, the service area map, which I mentioned, our 2017 budget summary, the latest annual report, the roster of the Budget and Operations Committee members who really determine the DID budget and operations and oversee the entire plan. And it's a cross-section of property owners and ratepayers in downtown Minneapolis, from larger to mid-sized to smaller, across many sectors of our downtown economy, and they are really the drivers of this district. So, with that, Mr. Chairman, I would just make one last question, and I want to say this with all due respect to the author and to the members of the committee. But you've heard from all property owners in downtown are important to me. But you've heard from one relatively small property owner who has been a consistent critic of the DID, and she has every right to do so. And you've heard from one attorney who, quite honestly, has conflated completely separate cases, as some of you have pointed out. And based on that, you have in front of you a piece of legislation that would upend these successful districts, not only in Minneapolis, but importantly, throughout the state of Minnesota. So I hope you'll take that into consideration as you evaluate the proposal in front of you. And if there are questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Kramer. Any questions from members? I guess not. Thank you, Mr. Kramer. Anyone else like to testify? Welcome to the Tax Committee, and please state your name and who you represent for the record, sir.
Sure. Mr. Chair, my name is Dale Grambush. I am a business owner in downtown White Bear Lake as well as a resident. I'm here as a member of the Downtown White Bear Lake Main Street Organization, which is a special service district. Chair and members, in 2001, I moved my business from Maplewood to downtown White Bear Lake, which looked much different than it does today. My notes are wrong, but I believe the special service district was really created back in 1991. That's actually when I moved my office to White Bear Lake, was in 1991. And downtown White Bear Lake looked much different than it does today. The city did a survey in 92 called the McComb Study, and as a part of that study, they determined if the city could use what was a special service district, we could do enhanced services or things that a normal city does not provide to help promote our downtown. That was established in 1992, and it was a petition by the business owners. It wasn't directed by the city, but a petition by the business owners. More than 25% of either the tax, I believe, tax capacity or square footage needed to sign a petition in favor of that. Then a survey was sent around, a petition sent around to property owners for their signatures. Again, I was not a part of it back then. Then that presentation was given to the city council, and a budget was sent, given as a part of the presentation of what services would be provided. I'm actually an insurance agent, so I don't consider myself like the retail store or the dining stores that really participate, in my opinion, of what the special service district does. But I was still interested in how I could help improve our downtown in areas that you can improve a downtown. So back in about, back in 2000, I was elected to the Main Street Board as a member. And that's where I really became more involved in and better understanding. You know, I've gone to my city when my streets were reconstructed in front of my house, as well as when my streets were reconstructed in front of my office. And I spoke to the city about the special assessment at that time, and I see that as completely different than a special service district. These are not the same two types of activities. Our special service district in the downtown, we have a volunteer board, 15 members. We meet once a month, and we discuss how we're going to use these funds to help promote our downtown. We do print advertising, or whether it's internet advertising, social media advertising. In fact, I just brought a couple examples of the latest Minneapolis St. Paul magazine. I probably should say that. Actually, I've been the promotion chair of the Special Service District since 2007, coming up to 10 years. Hopefully next month, though, I'll be calling myself the co-promotion chair. But we have a special in the Minneapolis St. Paul magazine. Main Street dollars were spent on that, not approved by the city. It was approved by the 15-member board. Hopefully, maybe in December, you saw an article in the Spaces magazine. These are the types of things that we're doing with our special service dollars, trying to drive people into the downtown, into our shops and businesses. You know, do all businesses say that they receive the same benefit? Most likely not. You know, those that are on the outside of the perimeter maybe don't feel they say receive the same benefit as those on the very inside or core. But in White Bear Lake, we charge a fee based on the square footage of your first floor of your business building. It happens to be just over 9 cents a square foot. On second floor, we charge a fee of just under 2 cents a fee, because we realize the advertising we're doing, the special activities we do, I heard banners mentioned before, we have a banner program also. These are all things to drive people to our downtown, to enhance our downtown. I think that you should not change the current special service district. I hope you do not support the changes. I'll take any questions if I can answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Grambush. Questions from members? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since one of the key questions before us with the amended bill is the basis on which charges happen, I thought it was intriguing your 9 cents a first floor square foot, which is typically where your retail operation, you're interacting with the public is, versus 2 cents. And given what you know about the types of businesses in your business district, would switching it to their net tax capacity, their actual property tax value, mean a major shift in who would be paying what within your special service district?
Mr. Granbush.
I'm not even sure what net tax capacity is some days. That seems more, it would seem like a big change. You know, it's very, I have to go out and get signatures or help with signatures, and I think it's very easy to present a case based upon the square footage. Again, we're trying to drive traffic into our downtown, and it's based on your first floor square footage.
Thank you, Mr.
It would be a big change.
Thank you.
Other questions? Seeing none, we have another testifier, I believe. Please state your name and who you represent for the committee, please.
Good morning. My name is Amy Wimmer, and I represent the Minneapolis DID.
Good morning, Ms. Wimmer.
The desire of commercial property owners in creating the business service district was to provide a consistent experience for visitors and employees. This is not a new idea, as others have said. It's based on business districts in other cities, D.C., Chicago, Denver, even Duluth. The desire of the Minneapolis DID is to ensure that as a person walks from block to block, from a baseball game to a restaurant, or from a hotel to an office, there's a consistency in cleanliness and safety. The goal of our improvement district was to provide a clean, green, and safe downtown, which provides a welcome experience for workers and visitors. As Steve mentioned earlier, commercial property ratepayers are in charge of determining the use of service charges and monitoring and evaluating the quality of the enhanced services they determine are needed within the district boundaries. Our committee is comprised of a diverse group of ratepayers representing hospitality, sports, education, real estate, retail, and others. We meet to discuss the needs of the district for each budget year. The group meets monthly to determine the amount of money needed to provide clean, green, and safe district and how it should be allocated based on those needs. Our strategic plan for 2018 is to continue to provide a robust support for safe and clean ambassadors, continue support for greening activities, and continue communications to the ratepayers and visitors. Our belief is all businesses and residents in the district benefit by raising the level of the experience downtown. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wimmer. Questions, members? Seeing none, thank you. Mr. Carlson.
No, that Carlson, sorry. I'm like, I'm not testifying. Lots of Carlsons.
We are in a Scandinavian state.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. I just want to express our opposition to both the original bill and the amended bill. Going back in time, the special service district concept, actually, I think if you read some of the past statutes, originated in some special laws way back in 1983. And was made a permanent feature, but was made generally available to cities in 1996 and has been used very successfully by cities with their business communities in mind to provide extra levels of services within a certain geographic area. Several cities could not be here today, just wanted me to express that these have been very successful joint ventures with their business community, and that we would really oppose any chance or any changes that would make it more difficult to use or less flexible to use the special service district option. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. You didn't want to have all 854 come here. All right. Questions from members? Mr. Carlson? Representative Carlson, do you have a question?
No, sir.
No Carlson to Carlson question. All right. Any other persons from the audience that would like to testify? Seeing none, Chair Gaskowski, would you like to do a summary?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate the discussion today. I think this is an area we need to have certainly some more inquiry on, and I think the discussion on both sides of this was good, an area that we need to learn more about as we look at what's going on with fees in cities and counties throughout our state.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with that, Chair Deskowski renews his motion to lay over House File 2412 as amended. The next bill on the docket, we will entertain House File 654. Chair Deskowski moves House File 654 to be laid over for possible inclusion. Chair Deskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We have an A1 amendment also, I see. Would you like to get your bill in proper form?
Oh, I do have an A1 amendment. Yes, Mr. Chair, if I could move the A1 amendment.
Okay. Any discussion on the A1 amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
The A1 amendment is adopted. To your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill contains really in its entirety, with the exception of two tweaks, and that was one of them, and there was another one similar to that in earlier committee. All of this information was in, all of this bill was included in House File 848 that passed the House in 2015. So what the bill does is there's two major components to it. One is the Property Taxpayer Empowerment Act, which provides that if a city or county comes forward in its certified levy in December at a level that is higher than it was the previous December, it would empower property taxpayers and citizens, actually, throughout that jurisdiction to seek to develop the necessary threshold amongst a petition to which, if they reach that threshold, could place the issue of the level of property tax levy on the ballot the following November. If the taxpayers prevail at that November election, then the levy would be reset to the level that it was the year prior. And so that's the Property Taxpayer Empowerment Act. It's an alternative to levy limits that we talked about extensively 2 years ago, and as I mentioned, was part of the omnibus bill. Also included is a series of provisions that aim to take special elections and referendums throughout the state amongst counties, schools, cities, and townships and move them to the November election, both in odd and even numbered years. And Mr. Chair and members, what this provides is that instead of in special elections that are held many times on an obscure date that the bulk of the population is not aware of, where we get 10 to 15% voter turnout, we can have opportunities for 80, 70, 80, or 90% voter turnout, and we can avoid the additional costs that exist on a special election that is held on a date that is different than the November election. So that's what the bill aims to achieve, and I stand for questions.
Thank you, Chair Deskowski, for that introduction. I see we have three persons on the testifying list. Members, do you have any questions before we hear testimony? Seeing none, we'll call Gary Carlson, League of Minnesota Cities. I think you were just here. Welcome back.
Mr. Chair, members, Gary Carlson with the League of Minnesota Cities. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on House File 654. Let me say at the outset that many of the sections of this bill that deal with moving the elections to the general election are probably less of an issue for cities, although there are some flexibility concerns that that may evolve or we may see with cities. Although I will say that Representative Druskowski last year did carve out emergency and what was the other term we used in there? We did add some carve-out for elections that may have to be held, for example, to issue GO bonds to respond to an emergency. So that takes away some of our concern about moving the elections to the general. We did some research on that last year that we shared with the committee. For those of you who were not here, I think more of those elections tend to be school districts, and I think they will testify today as well. Our major concern with the bill is really with the Taxpayer Empowerment Act that begins in Section 10, and there's some related sections that relate to that. What I would urge the committee to consider is the way that this would roll out is that the trigger for the referendum, the reverse referendum, would be a levy increase in 1 year. The election would not be held until the next year. That could ultimately roll the levy back to the preceding year's amount. So, for example, if a city were to propose raising its levy this fall for payment in 2018 over what the levy was in 2017, it could trigger an election in sometime in 2018, to affect the 2019 levy to roll back to 2017. So this would create some budgetary challenges for cities because of the way it would fit into our property tax system. You know that our property taxes are set once a year by cities, counties, townships, and school districts, and to make this reverse referendum work, it would basically have a kind of a two-year lag in the implementation effects. If a reverse referendum were to deny the city or county or school district from raising its levy. So that is our major concern with the bill, Mr. Chair, and with that I would stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Members, questions? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Carlson. Next, we'll call another Carlson, Keith Carlson. Is Keith here? Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Keith Carlson, Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association that consists of 10 of the regional center, greater Minnesota counties, and 4 counties here in the metropolitan area. I also appear in opposition to the tax power empowerment portion of this bill. As Mr. Gary Carlson just went through, this provision would go into effect any time that there's a levy increase, even of $1. This caused particular angst for counties because we're subject to unfunded mandates almost every year. In the past year, we were subject to unfunded mandates relating to new cost shares for operations of the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center for Community Behavioral Health Hospitals. We have to go somewhere to get the money or liabilities that are imposed to us by the legislature. They clearly anticipate that we're going to come up with the dollars, and you know that we're going to come up with the dollars with property taxes. I also, frankly object to the so-called empowerment of taxpayers. Minnesota property taxpayers are probably the most empowered individuals in the nation. Our current truth in taxation law, where the individuals receive preliminary tax statements and followed by requirement that a public hearing must be held before those levies can be authorized, is probably the most transparent process in the nation and gives great significant access to taxpayers to influence the decisions. Finally, if anybody, taxpayers, aggrieved after accessing those processes, they can always vote out the city council people, the mayors, the county board members if they're unhappy with their decisions. Again, I urge the committee not to pass this provision. With that, I'll conclude. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Questions from members? Seeing none, before we move up the alphabet, any more Carlsons out there that would like to testify? Seeing none, I guess we have Grace Kelleher. Is Grace here?
Yes.
Thank you, and state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. We represent elected school board members from every district in the state here.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We do have concerns following sort of the cities and counties approach. My brothers, Carlson, do a very good job telling you some of the problems with the bill, and I want to concur. But school districts are a little bit different than counties and schools. And we believe, especially the addition of the local option revenue, the board-approved referendum, and previous referendum amount along with a ballot question to either ask for capital or operating money can make that ballot really confusing. And I hope if you all remember, let's look back to November, if you had one of these school district questions on your ballot, it was below where the judges are. So in order to get people to focus on it, putting this on in a November election where you have all the links of individuals up, A, makes it hard to find, and B, makes it very difficult for us to communicate with taxpayers the implications of their choice. And I know Representative Drazkowski feels very strongly that this addition in the ballot, at the ballot question, will help voters. Our concern is without some distinctive discussion of what basis they're used and how they're figured and how they're set, it becomes very difficult in the ballot box for taxpayers to understand what's going forward. I would encourage Representative Drazkowski to look at emergencies and disasters. And I think we need to think about in a school district that only has one boiler and that boiler starts clunking away, that is something we need to move on and move on quickly. And your bill thinks about that, but we'd like you to expand it more of the kind of disasters you're speaking of in emergencies going forward. Because we still have to meet notification timelines, publication timelines, in order to have one of these special elections going forward. And last but not least, Mr. Carlson from the county has talked about unfunded mandates. And if you've been in an education committee at all, you know we talk about unfunded mandates all the time. And because we cannot levy from any other source, and we have to go to the voters, except for these three levies, we need you to be less heavy-handed with us going forward. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Kelleher. Representative Lunan has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the testifier, would you agree it's easier for a voter to understand what's on the ballot if they're physically at the polling place? The turnout on a general election is a lot higher than in a special election. It seems to me that we would be missing an opportunity if we didn't pull it into a general election.
Ms. Kelleher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative, I believe we've done an analysis of what turnout looks like and how the passage rates vary from an off-cycle, off-year election to a general election. And there really isn't much difference. And we can go back 6 years, and I'm going to actually talk about more election data on the next bill. But I would be happy to provide that to you. I think that assumption that your higher turnout means you're going to lose more school district elections isn't accurate, and at least hasn't played out in the last 5 to 10 years when my association's been collecting the data.
Thank you. Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned the idea of emergency situations, boiler potentially going out and needing to go to the voters for that. And I am just wondering if the schools have a reserve emergency access or funds to access in those situations, and if not, would that be maybe something that we as a legislature should consider working with the school boards to develop? I just think of Dave Ramsey, and he talks a lot about, you know, emergencies and unexpected things. They're not unexpected because we know they're going to happen at some point. You know, you're going to blow a tire and you're going to need to take your car in. So how can we better help the schools prepare for those situations?
Representative Whitman, I believe if they're not in statutory operating debt, they do have funds. But Ms. Kelleher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Whalen. That's a really good question. I think it's a little of both. Sometimes there's money available to do that, and there's other districts where they're not. But I think about a school shooting. If, in fact, a horrible item would happen in a school district there, they may want to put safety improvements immediately throughout their building. And the funds to do that, at least from the community, might want them immediately or as close as possible to move that project forward. So flexibility. I know when school districts have been hit by a flood, for instance, we had a school district up here for a long time talking about the mold that they have been going to their voters with the enhanced equalization and still couldn't get it passed. They were feeding kids in the gym on the floor for a while. So if we could get in front of some of those situations, we'd certainly be willing to work. And I know Representative Drazkowski does care about his schools a lot and want to make sure we get that piece right.
Follow up, Ms. Representative Wayland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just and thank you for your response. That's helpful to hear. Just to kind of comment, and I'll hand it back to Representative Drazkowski if he maybe wants to clarify as well. But because there is language that talks about except in cases of emergency, and I know sometimes, and maybe we should be more definitive, but I would say a school shooting would definitely, and I think the minds of most people, count as an emergency situation. However, I appreciate what you're saying about working with us to develop emergency funds, because I think that's probably the better, in my mind, the better route to go. And I think that just willingness to work on this and to keep moving forward is a good idea, because as my colleague Representative Luna pointed out, we do have much higher turnout at the general election, and so trying to work with folks to make sure they're informed going into the ballot box would be, in my mind, the path we want to move toward.
Thank you, Representative Whalen. Other questions? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. And
thank
we'll
you, Mr. Chairman.
And we'll call Mr. Hilgard up. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Matt Hilgart, and I represent the Association of Minnesota Counties. I'll try not to be too redundant since past testifiers kind of hit on most of my points here, but we have had a great discussion over the last few years on this particular proposal, and I believe it was even included in the House Property Tax Division report last year. AMC still remains opposed to this provision because of some of the logistical nightmares that Mr. Keith Carlson and Mr. Gary Carlson raised a little earlier. If there is a 1 cent increase in our levy, it could potentially trigger Section 7 of this. And I think our main concern not only revolves around local control and local decision-making, just like you, our commissioners are in the community and representing taxpayers in that community, and they hear firsthand from the community on any potential increase. They also have open discussions throughout the year and more formal budget conversations starting in July and August, where the public is more than welcome to participate, participate in the truth of taxation process and in their final budget process. The one issue I'd like to also emphasize, as Mr. Carlson stated, is that counties are mandated to do several services, including some of our safety net services, such as child protection. And several counties, some of your counties on this committee, are looking to hire more additional child protection workers in their counties. And one of the questions we had when we raised this to our membership was, what would happen if we needed to hire additional child protection workers to uphold the mandate that we were given, but then all of a sudden this was overturned, our levy was reduced by that amount, and we were left basically with no ways to fund those workers. So there are several questions that we still have, and because of that, we do remain opposed to House File 654.
Thank you, Mr. Hilgard. Questions of Mr. Hilgard, members? Seeing none, next is Ms. Nauman. Welcome to the Property Tax Committee, and if you'd state your name and who you represent for the record, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'll be very brief today. I don't want to repeat testimony. My name is Patricia Nauman. I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities, representing cities in the seven-county metropolitan area, and I just want to echo our organization's respectful but strong opposition to House File 64, particularly Section 10 relating to the Property Tax Empowerment Act. I will just add that Metro Cities believes that provisions such as this bill do undermine the role of local officials in being able to represent their local communities and the needs and circumstances of those communities, which is what they are elected to do. And I do want to just add that I believe Mr. Keith Carlson had referenced the Truth in Taxation law. We believe that that law is adequate and important in terms of giving property taxpayers the ability to speak out with respect to taxes. So we, again, just respectfully but strongly do oppose the provisions in this bill relating to that act. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Nauman. Questions from Ms. Nauman? Anyone else from the audience that would like to testify on House File 654? Welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name and who you represent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Dozeland. I represent the Minnesota Association of School Business Officials and the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. We'd like to just reiterate our opposition to the proposal specifically in regards to the timing of elections. I do want to note there's an omnibus elections bill moving in the House that calls for uniform general elections. I believe it's 4 or 5 times a year. I think that is a better alternative to allowing only one election date. A couple of points. School districts often hold special elections specifically for bond elections. I do want to point out that off-general election years do have lower voter turnout, but they often draw more focused scrutiny and attention. They don't get lost in the mix of the presidential election or the governor's race or whatever, a whole host of elections that are on the ballot. I also want to remind members that school districts are required to send out by first-class mail a notice to voters of the general of the bond election questions. They have to do it for, I believe, 14 days before the election. Another point I'd like to make is that special elections still fail. There's no guarantee that a special election will pass because of voter turnout. Just a quick review of some elections, the last two election cycles. In 2016, there were 24 special elections, 18 failed. In 2016, there were 11 general school bond elections, 7 failed in the general election year. In 2015, there were 27 special elections for school districts, 13 failed. And then in the general election in 2015, there were 44 general elections, and almost half failed. So there's no guarantee that an election in a special election will pass. Lastly, I just would like to point out that only allowing school districts to hold bond referendums in November could possibly increase the cost of a bond project should the voters choose to approve that referendum. It could also result in delays in the construction project because of the 18-month construction window. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Joslin. Any questions from members? Seeing none, anyone else from the audience? Seeing none, concluding remarks, Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Thank you for the discussion. Again, kind of two parts to the bill. And in regard to the opposition, those who are, focused on the discussion about moving the special election referendums to November, it really shouldn't be about how many special elections or bond referendums pass or fail. But rather, we should be looking to increase voter turnout so that we have an 80% participation rate in these special elections and referendums instead of 10%. And instead of $30,000 for a school referendum, we'd be looking at a zero cost to the school district for that referendum if they hold on a general election day. Makes sense to the taxpayers. It makes sense to the voters. It just makes sense all around. In terms of the Property Taxpayer Empowerment Act, if we were proposing levy limits here today, which has been done by the legislature over and over and over and over again in our history, you'd have the same type of opposition here from governments because they don't want more accountability than we offer them already, and we can expect that reaction from them, and you saw that here today. I will also point out that the bill does not provide that if there's an increase in the levy that there's automatically going to be a reverse referendum. That's only going to happen if the property taxpayers feel moved to go forward and do the work in order to develop the petition and get the petition signatures necessary in order to bring that referendum forward. And that's only going to happen, members, in the case where you have a government that is not properly in touch with its voters. And as the author, I truly believe that there are a lot of local governments around Minnesota that do a very good job communicating with their voters and with their taxpayers. And in those situations, if there's a 1%, 2%, 3%, or 4% increase, as long as the voters know and are brought along in the discussion by the government officials in terms of what the need is, I believe that they won't go forward and exercise the empowerment that is placed with them within this. But if they do not have good communication or not in touch with the people of their jurisdiction, then it would empower those property taxpayers to act. And really, members, property taxpayers need to be listened to rather than looked at as an inconvenience. And that's what this bill looks to address.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Yu Kim has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
really, well, part of it's one question and then one statement. In a section of the bill, and I didn't grab it today, but we've talked about this before when it went through GovOps, why do you exclude cities under, I think it's 2,000 or is it 200?
Chair Dzhokhovsky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Joachim. It's 500. And we had it in there at 500 last year. That's why it's in there this year. I can't remember what my answer is to that, Representative Joachim, from last time, but we had that discussion 2 years ago, and I think we were just trying to make it provide more flexibility for those cities, those very small cities. We've heard about some of their administrative struggles with some of them that didn't get their LGA paperwork in, kind of the same issues, I think, that we want to try to avoid with the small cities.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Chair Dzhokhovsky, that worries me because in a way you're kind of saying the folks on those city councils are smarter than the folks in cities over 500 that are tasked by the voters to make the same decisions. And your trigger mechanism, we just talked about worrying about cities or school districts in special elections, or as we have with cities, that about 50% of our cities have odd year elections. And we know the voter turnout isn't quite as high, but those taxpayers seem to be much more focused on what's at hand, what that they're voting on, so we actually get a lot of quality versus quantity. But my concern is with that 10% trigger in the last election, say in Hopkins, I had done the math and looked at one of the elections when in the 9 years I was on. One of the elections, there was only 879 people that voted. We have over 18,000 people in town. About 12,000 of those are registered voters. So if you take 10% of 879, that'd be 87 people. You could go to a farmer's market and sit there for an hour and get 87 people to sign on to just about anything that said, hey, do you want to pay extra taxes? You could walk through one of our apartment buildings where 56% rental and do the same thing. I think that's way too low of a trigger if you're going to look at this. And then also one last comment. This is substantially changing the way we have a representative democracy. We elect our local electeds to set the budget. That's one of the main things that they do. And we're tipping that upside down on the head and turning into like an issue of a referendum state where you then have everything can be overturned and flip that every 2 years, affect their budgets that have already been set. If folks aren't happy with what their city council is doing, they can go to the ballot box and get rid of them. And that's the most direct form of democracy I think we should be looking at. Thank you.
And Representative Joachim, Ms. Dalton has a clarification on the statement you made.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the only thing I would point out, it is 10% of the voters at the last general election. So if you had a special election that had 800, that would not be included.
Thank you, Ms. Dalton. You're right, but what I'm saying is 50% of the cities that have general elections on odd years, the turnout is a lot different than I believe we had a trigger in one of Representative Rundbeck's bills that actually said 10% in the last in the municipality in the last state general election. So that could be quite a different number. So I'm just saying, you know, right now you're treating cities that have an election on an odd year different than they have on an even year when it comes to that trigger.
Thank you, Representative Joachim and Ms. Dalton, for that clarification. Representative Loeffler has a question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Dzhokhovsky. One of the testifiers mentioned the truth in taxation process in which we actually give a customized estimate of the property tax burden to every single property owner. And what I hear from local governments is people appreciate that, but they don't show up very often to the truth in taxation hearing, which I think says the local governments are doing a good job of communicating with the residents, not getting that kind of response. But I am concerned that this puts on another set of taxpayer revolt tools that could be used by people who are just reacting to the economy, not necessarily to what's happening in that particular jurisdiction. And the examples that were brought forward of counties with unfunded mandates and shifts. I can just say in my county, the shift to asking counties to pick up the cost, a significant part of the cost of Anoka Regional Mental Health Treatment and the CBHS is the small community-based hospitals in greater Minnesota. In my county alone, that's $13.5 million. That's the equivalent of a 2% property tax levy. And so if you're a county commissioner, how are you supposed to measure complying with state law that says you must serve these people and you must pick up the cost with a potential taxpayer revolt that's just unhappy with property taxes? And how would you expect that to play out? Would you expect that to go to court and have the courts resolve it? I mean, I think all of our local jurisdictions are subject to unfunded mandates, but particularly the counties have been subject in recent years to a lot of cost shifting on mandated services in which they don't have any other revenue source. You can't charge someone who's lost their job because they're in the middle of a psychosis and in crisis, in a mental health crisis. You just can't charge them for that care. And it's often lengthy, and it's $1,300 a day. To get that level of treatment. And how would you see that playing out in a practical way for a county confronted with that?
Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Loeffler. Representative Loeffler, we have counties that are doing it now. We have at least one county in the state that hasn't had a levy increase in 8 years. And I didn't bring them here, and I wanted to bring them during the LGA discussion, but we were had kind of a full committee that day. But, you know, it would be about setting priorities, and they would, you know, if a set of taxpayers and a set of voters in a particular jurisdiction exercised this, the local city or county would be in a position where they would have to reprioritize their spending within their budget and figure out how to live within their means. People do it every day, and many governments do too, and in that case those governments would be asked to do the same by their taxpayers.
Thank you, Chair Drazkowski. Other questions? Follow-up? Representative Loeffler?
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair, I do think that the amount of discretion that counties have is pretty limited. Because of the nature of the work that they do and their relationship with the state on health and human services and corrections, which is the majority of the services that they provide. And so I think that that's limited. But I'm wondering if you can give us some examples of cities or counties or school districts that have had huge turnouts equivalent to the petition requirements, or at least getting close to implying that, that showed up at a truth and taxation hearing. It felt like they weren't being heard, didn't have the local government responsive to them. Because I haven't heard of that, and I'd be really interested to know if that has been a problem in other parts of the state.
Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Loeffler, I haven't counted numbers. I've been at some, not in the past few years, but several years back where we had 30 or 40 people at a truth and taxation hearing. I don't know how many you'd be looking for, but of course this is a different mechanism, a different approach, a different way for voters and taxpayers to get involved, one that empowers them with some direct action rather than one that sends them to a truth and taxation hearing where they basically listen to the officials opine about why they spent their money. So this is one that actually empowers them to act, which I think in situations where governments were not listening, I think they would act. In situations where governments were listening, they very likely would not.
Thank you. Other questions, members?
Mr. Chair, if I could.
Yes.
Representative Joaquin mentioned earlier that for some reason construed something I said about the small cities. Representative Joaquin, I never said small cities were not smarter than larger cities. You did. And I take offense to that. I've got many small cities in my district, a number of them under 500, and some of the smartest people in my district come from those cities and represent them. So that has nothing to do with this, and that's not something I said or should be construed. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I was saying, Representative Skousky, maybe I didn't say it clear enough, is that by exempting cities under 500, in a way you're saying that those city council people are smarter than the folks that represent towns over 500 because you're giving them the exemption, that they don't have to worry about a reverse referendum or somebody second guessing what their levy is set at. So that's what I said. Sorry if it was misconstrued.
Representative Drazkowski.
Mr. Chair, and again, Representative, I am not saying that they are smarter or not smarter. Not at all. They don't have the resources that a large city, like some of them that send lobbyists to this capital to lobby in front of us every day, do. We heard examples in the past week about small cities that were here where people who are not even employed, there's not even an employee in the city. They're volunteering their time. And so completely different situation. Has nothing to do about intellect or intellectual capacity.
Representative Youakim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't want to keep arguing, Chair Drazkowski, but a lot of those small cities belong to the League of Minnesota Cities, and they have a lobbyist that does come up here. So there is a correction.
And I think with that, we'll leave it at the last word. Any other questions? Seeing none, Representative Drazkowski renews his motion. It is a motion also. Renews his motion to lay over House File 654 as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Chair Drazkowski, would you like to resume the gavel or would you like to do the next bill from where you're at?
I think there will be a lot of testifiers here, Mr. Chair. I'll leave room for them.
Very well.
Okay, members, we're going to, I think we can maybe move this later, but we have in front of us the Delete Everything Amendment for House File 603. And House File 603 is the Ag Bond Referendum Bill. So that's the bill we'll be eventually amending this to. And with us are Mr. Hines and Ms. Dalton, who are looking to lead us through the division report. Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, do you want to give us any guidance on how we should do this, or just
I will leave it up to the two of you. Is there anyone else who is going to help us lead through? Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mr. Michael will be coming up and doing the public finance and TIF and miscellaneous articles at the end. So okay. We'll do the first four.
I will leave it up to the two of you to decide how you want to lead us through the amendment.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'll start going section by section, try to keep it kind of quick, but feel free to tell me we need to move faster or slower if you want. Article 1, property tax article. Section 1 is a provision that allows cell towers to be installed on property in ag preserves. This was a provision from 2015 and 2016 tax bills. Sections 2 and 22 require counties to treat its levy for a soil and water conservation district as a special taxing district, and to require that the levy be certified separately so that it would show as a separate line on the tax statement. Section 3 is the ag containment provision, which modifies the exemption in current statute to limit it to secondary containment tax, containment tanks, catch basins, and berms. That's effective retroactively for pay 2016. Section 4, apprenticeship training, changes the criteria so that a property in a certain township really ends up being one property, can qualify for that doesn't meet the criteria in current law for the apprenticeship training for an exemption for that facility. Section 5 is a exemption for a electric generation facility near Owatonna. Section 6 is changes to the way we the exemption status for leased seasonal recreational land. So this is seasonal recreational property that's located on government-owned property, basically. And currently that land has to be the land is taxable unless the county exempts it. This would automatically exempt that land from taxation. And that law currently applies only to non-commercial seasonal recreational, but this would also extend that to seasonal recreational, commercial seasonal recreational property. Section 7 changes the wind energy production system and clarifies how you combine small elements into bigger systems for the purpose of levying the wind energy tax. Section 8 is a restriction on deed transfers. It allows the county board to review a transfer to make sure that it conforms with county land use regulations in the areas outside of city limits. Section 9 allows residents or shareholders of a manufactured home park cooperative to include their ground lease payments when filing for the homestead credit refund. Sections 10 and 11 came from the Bar Association. This was language relating to ag homesteads that are owned by grantor trusts, and currently it affects their homestead status. This would allow them to retain homestead status in certain circumstances. Section 12 is a provision that relates to small structures on property of manufactured homes and when they're subject to taxation. Currently, anything over $1,000 is considered taxable. This would raise that threshold to $10,000. Section 13 extends eligibility for Class 1C homestead resort properties to. Right now, they have to be on water. This would also allow them if they were on abutting a state trail. Section 14, Class 2 ag property. This would allow land enrolled in a conservation program administered by a local agency, town, city, or water conservation district to qualify as agricultural for property tax purposes. Currently, only land that's allowed to qualify is land that's in REM or CRP program. So this would extend that to local conservation programs as well. Section 15 really has two pieces. The first part is a provision that allows garage condominiums that have separate legal descriptions to be classified as 4BB with a class rate of 1%. And the second provision reduces the class rate for service organizations that are operated by congressionally chartered veterans organizations. So it reduces their class rate from 1.5 to 1.0. Section 16 makes a couple changes in the way we treat the disabled veteran classification. It allows a spouse to receive the benefit if the veteran qualified at the time of death, even if they had not yet begun to receive the benefit. And then we also eliminate the annual application requirement so that the veterans do not have to apply each year. We do require the county veteran service organization to provide the assessor with information on the changes and do obligate the veteran to report when there has been a change in their status. Section 17, overvalued property. This allows a person who successfully challenges their valuation in tax court to allow them to appeal to the tax court to look back one more year at their valuation, so that if tax court finds in their favor, it allows them to look back and say maybe in the previous year it was also overvalued, and where normally that would no longer be available to them, that appeal. Sections 18, 19, and 20 relate to the state general levy, and they basically do two things. They exempt the first $200,000 of each commercial industrial property from the levy, and then for both the seasonal recreational and the commercial industrial portions of the state general levy, they eliminate the inflator so that the levy is frozen at the payable 2017 level for pay 2018 and thereafter. Section 21 is a provision that allows a municipality that is located outside the Metropolitan Transit District area and has a fiscal disparities contribution in excess of 8% of its total tax capacity to retain its state general levy by an amount equal to the excess tax contribution times the local tax rate. Section 23 clarifies that a postmark or registration mark qualifies as proof of timely mailing of current or delinquent tax payments. Section 24 equalizes the penalties between the first and the second half late payments of property taxes. Currently, there's a different schedule applying to the first half and the second half payments. Section 25 abatements allows for one time per taxpayer allows the county treasurer to abate the penalty for late payment if an envelope is postmarked one day late. Section 26 provides that property, that rural vacant land, is subject to the same due date as agricultural land, so that there's an agricultural land is allowed for their second half payment to be paid by November 15th versus the general rate of general date of October 15th. And Section 26 just puts rural vacant land into that same category with that later due date for the November payment or for the late payment. Section 27, and I think maybe turn over to Mr. Clayman for a little description of sections 27 to, I think, 40 that are all part of one big package of dealing with transfers.
Mr. Hines, on section 26, I know we put an exception in there for Representative Eklund brought it to my attention. We carve out one extra year for the Northern Forest District, too, right?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Clayman.
Mr. Chair, moving on to Section 27, that was part of the big bill that had there's 18 or 19 sections that are here in the Delete Everything Amendment relating to the management and disposal of tax-forfeited land, and there was, if you remember, there was some testimony on this from Ms. Geis from the Minnesota Association of County Officers. And so the next few provisions relate to provisions that were in that bill. Section 27 just allows a county auditor to offer financial literacy counseling as part of an agreement to enter into a confession of judgment. Section 28, period of redemption, clarifies what the redemption period is for targeted communities. That's mostly just a change in the language that's being used in the statute to refer to targeted communities. Sections 29 and 30 allow a county to commence actions to reduce the redemption period for both abandoned and vacant property. Section 31 provides that a property owner that's a governmental entity is not bound to agreements to maintain the property with public funds. There was, I think, a grain elevator that had a requirement to provide maintenance on an ongoing basis. So that would deal with that issue. Section 32, right of entry, allows the county auditor to enter and protect or enter a property to protect and secure that property if it's vacant or unoccupied. Section 33, sale method, requirements, effects, that just allows a county board to sell individual parcels through a real estate broker or other means if the county decides. Section 34, duties of commissioner, requires the commissioner of revenue to issue a conveyance to the county auditor in conjunction with a closing instead of after the closing if there's a loan commitment. That's available. Section 35, online auctions allows online auctions of for sales of tax forfeited property. Section 36, this broadens the number of prohibited purchasers or clarifies the number of prohibited purchasers of tax forfeited land. to include people, for instance, who have a revoked rental license in the past 5 years, or people who were a vendee on a canceled contract for the purchase of tax forfeited property or own a property with a housing code violation. And there's a provision there regarding straw buyers as well that's clarified. Section 37, land on or adjacent to public waters, authorizes a county to sell property adjacent to public waters with written authorization from the Commissioner of Natural Resources. Section 38 is just an amendment to the notice requirements for the online auctions authority under Section 35. Section 39 reduces the length of time that an owner at the time of forfeiture may repurchase non-homestead property from 1 year to 6 months. Section 40 makes some technical and clarifying changes and also amends a reference regarding the limitation of the repurchase period in the previous section. And Section 41, I think if it's okay with the committee, I could skip ahead to some of the other provisions in that big tax forfeiture bill and then go back to Section 41 with Mr. Hines. Section 44 grounds authorizes evictions after the expiration of the redemption period. Section 45, removal and storage of property. That allows a plaintiff to dispose of personal property held to enforce a lien 60 days after the notice of the order to vacate. And I believe those are all the – oh, there's a – I believe in the repealer. There's a repeal of a statute that required a notice requirement for parcels that haven't been sold a year before the expiration of the redemption period. So those sections relate to the big tax forfeited land bill that we heard in the committee, and then to go back to Section 41, I'll turn it over to Mr. Hines.
Thank you, Mr. Klein. Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, Section 41 then goes along with Section 9, which is the provision that allowed residents of manufactured home cooperatives to include their ground lease payments in filing for the homestead credit refund. Section 42 allows a property that's enrolled in the Metropolitan Ag Preserves Program to be terminated upon the death of an owner of the property, subject to a 50% penalty, additional taxes of the 50% penalty of the current year's taxes. Section 43 is a provision that allows cell towers to be installed on property within a Metropolitan Agricultural Preserve. Currently, that would be prohibited because it's a commercial use. Section 46 allows the Carrollton County Board to impose a levy for recreational services in the unorganized territory of Sawyer. Sections 47 and 48 establish a property tax reform working group consisting of legislators only to be staffed by legislative staff, and they are to make a report by February 15th of 2018, and they're to come up with proposals for restructuring and simplifying Minnesota's property tax system. And Section 49, Mr. Klayman, referred to one aspect of the repealer. The other aspect is that it repeals the requirement that for the extra licensing for assessors that was put in place a couple years ago. So it repeals that requirement that they all obtain an accredited license. Mr. Chair, should we go right away to Article 2?
Let's walk through the whole thing, yep. And then we can go to justifiers and questions.
Okay. I think I will go ahead and start with Article 2 and then turn it over to Ms. Dalton. Sections 1 through 9 basically all are the provisions for the 50% credit, provide a 50% credit to agricultural property for all school debt levies. So this is a provision that we also carried in 25 and 26. I believe that was at 40%. This is at 50%. And the number of sections are necessary just to cross-reference a number of things. Sections 1 and 2 make a little change in the payments between the Department of Education and school districts and accelerate some of those credit payments so that they get to the districts a little sooner than they would otherwise to make up for the fact that they're not getting the agricultural payments for the bonds. Section 10 then is a provision related to the renter's property tax refund, and it provides that it eliminates the current 17% assumption for the property tax refund and instead substitutes, as you can see on the summary on page 8, that you use a rate of 16.5% for the city of Minneapolis, 14% city of St. Paul, 15% for Anoka and Dakota counties, and the rest of Hennepin and Ramsey, and then 14% for everywhere else in the state, based on most recent Department of Revenue studies of that, what the actual rent is. Section 11 is that same concept carried over to manufactured home park filings for PTR. Section 12 is an additional $3 million allocation to the Border City Enterprise Zone for those five cities on the west border of Minnesota. With that, I'll turn it over to Ms. Dalton.
Thank you, Mr. Hines. Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, sections 13 and 14 came from Representative David's bill, House File 1512. It provides a sparsity adjustment for cities with a population density of less than 30 persons per square mile. Sections 15 and 16, along with Section 19, are Representative Murphy's House File 773. This corrects the glitch in the LGA formula and makes the payments for 2017 for the cities that were affected in 2017 by that glitch. Section 17 is Representative Drazkowski's bill, House File 754, aid reductions for a World Fair or Expo. Section 18 is one of the amendments Representative Drazkowski offered to that same bill. It basically is an aid reduction for counties or cities that operate in an unauthorized diversion program. Section 19 is, as I said, is part of Representative Murphy's bill that makes the one-time adjustments in pay 2017 for the cities affected by the glitch. Section 20 is Representative Murphy's bill that provides a change in payment for a city that a town that incorporates into a city. It is slightly different than her bill. It does not make an adjustment in 2017. It starts the adjustment in 2018, and instead of giving them $115 per capita, it gives them the lesser of 20% of its certified levy in 2016 or 50% of its unmet need. So the increase for Rice Lake would be to $310,000, which is 25% of their levy. Section 21 is penalty forgiveness for the city of Oslo. Section 22 is the penalty forgivenesses for the cities of Dundee, Jeffers, and Woodstock. Section 23 is the Mille Lacs area property tax abatement that was in Representative Erickson's House File 1268. Section 24 is a variation on Representative Lowick's House File 1247. It provides, instead of increasing PILT payments permanently for the other acquired lands from $150 to $2, it provides supplemental payments of 50 cents per acre for the next biennium, the two-year period. Section 25.
Mr. Chair, sections 25 and 26 institute a one-time increase in homestead credit refunds in section 25 and renter property tax refunds in section 26 of refunds for that would be paid in 2018 or based on taxes payable in 2018 for homeowners and 2017 rents for renters. The Commissioner of Revenue is instructed to alter the schedule to increase homestead credit refunds by $58 million and renter refunds by $42 million for a total of $100 million between the two programs. So the Commissioner is instructed to change the co-pays or instructed as to how to make the adjustments to the schedule to spend that extra amount for property tax refunds payable in next year.
Ms. Stolen.
Mr. Chair, Article 3 is Representative Drazkowski's bill, House File 586, that basically requires the Outdoor Heritage Fund and the Environmental and Natural Resources Trust Fund to put aside money in an in-perpetuity fund to pay counties for their for foregone property taxes for land purchase out of those two funds. The only change in this language from the way the bill was presented in committee was the very last section, Section 18. And basically what Section 18 does is it clarifies that for money that's appropriated this year for fiscal 18 to purchase land, those funds do not have to put their money aside until fiscal year 19. This makes sure that if the natural resource bill and this bill passes simultaneously, we aren't messing up their accounts of what money they're currently.
Thank you, Ms. Dalton. We're on to TIF. Mr. Michael. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Article 4 is the tax increment financing article. Basically, this article contains the provisions, the tax increment provisions from House File 848. So it has the version of the League of Minnesota Cities bill that Representative Davids carried, in addition to local provisions for Burnsville, Duluth, Edina, Maple Grove, Anoka, Coon Rapids, Richfield, and St. Paul. All of those are the same as they passed in House File 1848, except Edina and Burnsville. Burnsville's given extra years to create their districts in that old 2008 special law, as is Edina in their special law. In addition, this article has Representative Paul Anderson's workforce housing TIF provision that allows the use of economic development districts for workforce housing, and it also includes new special laws that were not in 848 for Rochester, St. Louis Park, Washington County, CDA for Newport, South St. Paul, and Wayzata. And generally those are the same as they were heard by the committee, except the Rochester and St. Louis Parks have been narrowed somewhat.
Thank you, Mr. Michael. Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Article 5 is the local option sales and use taxes. Section 1 actually comes from House File 1504, Representative Nash's bill, which was a prohibition on local governments banning plastic bags or taxing them. This only has the tax portion, and it prohibits a local government from imposing a fee or tax on merchant-provided bags other than the existing local sales taxes. Section 2 is the Duluth Food and Beverage and Hotel Motel taxes that were in House File 848. Sections 4 through 6 were the Mankato bill as they left committee and were included in the vetoed omnibus tax bill last year. Section 7 is the Hermantown provisions also as they were in House File amended to reflect how they were in 848. The only differences in any of these would be if they held their election, which virtually all of them did. So the language has been amended to reflect the fact that the election, that all of these have already passed in, at local elections. Section 9 through 11 is the new Ulm bill as it was heard in committee. Section 12 and 27 is the Proctor bill as it was heard in committee. Sections 13 and 14 is the Albert Lee bill heard in committee. Section 15 is the North Mankato provision as it left, as it was included in the vetoed 848. Section 16 is Representative Keel's East Grand Forks sales tax. Section 17 is Representative Gunther's Fairmont local sales tax. Section 18 is Representative Nornes's Fergus Falls sales tax. Section 19 is Representative Sundin's Moose Lake sales tax. Section 20 is Representative Baker's New London sales tax. Section 21 is Representative Torkelson's Sleepy Eye lodging tax. The one change that has been made is that the allowed use for this lodging tax is the same as what's under the general lodging tax authority. So now 95% of this additional lodging tax must be used for tourism promotion. Section 22 is the Representative Baker's local sales tax for Spicer. Section 23 is Representative Bliss's local sales tax for Walker, as it was in Section 24 is Representative Hamilton's sales tax for the City of Windham. Section 25 is Representative Lean's sales tax for Clay County for their jail. Section 26 is Representative Lewick's sales tax for the Garrison Kathy O. West Mille Lacs Lake Sanitary District. And as I said, 27 is part of the Proctor provisions.
It was Lewis.
Thank you. Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, members of the division, Article 6 is the public finance article. It is the same version that passed in House File 848 that was pocket vetoed, with the exception that the increase in authority for HRAs to issue GO bonds and the expanded authority to approve street reconstruction bonds is deleted. And it also includes Representative Runbeck's bill that it authorizes in certain circumstances the ability to trigger reverse referendum for lease revenue bonds. Article 7 is the miscellaneous article. This article includes the chair's House File 465, which limits the ability to spend money for the Zip Rail project. It also includes Representative Vogel's bill that limited the ability of municipalities to impose franchise fees to raise revenue. The chair's bill that limits fees for municipal investigations of permitted uses. The repeal of the the political contribution refund is also included in this article. And lastly, Representative Metz's bill that increased the guarantee for the taconite municipal aid is included. The repealer also includes two new provisions, the Lewis and Clark aid that was enacted in 2014 but has never been used and is now obsolete because that project is being paid for with bond proceeds, is repealed, and the local performance measurement reporting to the state auditor is also being repealed.
Thank you, Mr. Michael. We made it through. Ms. Schill, were you going to walk us through the spreadsheet? Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. Kathy Schill from House Fiscal Analysis. And you should have in your possession a five-page spreadsheet that looks like this. And I will attempt to summarize this pretty quickly for you. On lines 1 through 3, you'll see a quick summary of
spending for property tax aids, credits, and refunds associated with the February forecast. On line two is the totals, are the totals for proposed general fund changes. I will take a look at the biennial total, the boxed squared for fiscal 18 and 19. This division report reflects general fund changes totaling $302,366,000. And for fiscals 20 to 21, it would be $384,508,000. Now, I will tell you that there is a qualification.
348, Ms. Shaw.
Oh, excuse me, $348,508,000. Yes. I will qualify this. I've characterized all of the changes in the bill in terms of general fund spending at this time. As this division report migrates to the overall omnibus tax bill, there will be items that will be reflected in the revenue side of the spreadsheet. For example, the state general levy changes. Those are all changes to the revenue side of this spreadsheet. And so it will look different as we put together the omnibus tax bill. I have characterized all these changes in terms of spending for just the overall presentation of the bill at this time. We'll start with the changes for property tax refund and other refund changes. Lines 6 through 27 shows you a number of those interaction changes of both PTR interactions and income tax interactions. The total of all of those changes, very small in many cases, Representative Bliss's bill, Petersburg, I made that mistake before, I'm so sorry, Detmer, Garofalo, Knobloch West, Pearson, and Backer. All of those changes have a total change of about $90,000 in fiscal 18 and 19 and just $9,000 in fiscal 20 and 21. On lines 32 through 35 or so, you see changes to the homestead credit state refund, the renter PTR. You'll see the additional supplemental amounts going to the homestead credit state refund. That's a $58 million in fiscal 19, just one time. Renters credit, $42 million in fiscal 19 only. And then Representative Druskowski's bill, House File 2186, where we reflect the determination of rent constituting property taxes. That's a negative $40.2 million in the first year and first biennium, and then a negative $82.2 million in 20 and 21. Line 36 shows you the repeal of the political contribution refund, totaling $9 million of a reduction in 18 and 19 and $10 million of a reduction in 20 and 21. There are a number of property tax changes reflected through lines 37, from 37 through 42 with nominal impacts. If you turn to page 2, lines 43 through 50 reflect the changes in the state general levy. Representative Pepin's bill, Representative Green's bill, and then you go to lines 46 through 50. These are the changes associated with the first tier 200K of commercial industrial property being exempted and the levy frozen. Those changes to the state general levy total $205 million or so in fiscal 18 and 19, and almost just shy of $332 million in fiscal 20 through 21. Lines 51 through 67 are local aid changes. Specifically, this is Representative Murphy's bill with the LGA formula amendment the forgiveness provisions for Oslo, Woodstock, Dundee, and Jeffers, and then also Representative Murphy's base your formula aid change to Rice Lake. This is different than what we heard in committee. There was a $468,000 cost there. In this division report, we've taken that to remain within the appropriation, so there'll be some minor shifting in that provision. Lines 68 through 72 reflect Representative Erickson's bill for the special property tax abatement for Aiken, Crow Wing County, and Mille Lacs counties. Line 73 represents Representative Drazkowski's bill having to do with adjustments for aid payments for contributions to the World Fair or unpermitted driver diversion programs. Lines 74 through 77 are the school building bond ag credit. That totals $42.7 million in fiscal 18 and 19 and $122.3 million in fiscal 20 through 21. The supplemental payment for PILT is reflected on line 79. Once again, for fiscal 18-19 only, that cost would be $6.9 million. There's several repealers in lines 81 through 87, and that brings us down to the total on line 98 of the $302.4 million in 18 and $348.5 million in 20 and 21. Page 3 of the spreadsheet lists all the items for property tax changes with no state fund impact, and those are on lines 103 through 118. Line 120 through lines 138 reflect all of the local option sales tax bills. Lines 139 through 156 reflect the TIF bills. And all of those have no cost. Line 158, 159 reflect the public finance bill at this time. There are no costs associated with that. Lines 161 through the end of the spreadsheet, 178, reflect changes to the non-general fund items. This is basically Representative Metz's bill, 1325, and Representative Drazkowski's bill, House File 586. Mr. Chair, that concludes the testimony on this spreadsheet.
Thank you, Ms. Schill. Members, you can see that when we add together two bills from two bianniums, you get a lot of provisions. So that's what we have. Commissioner Bowerly is here and would like to testify, and I want to make certain that if she's still here, is she still here? We want to give her a chance to testify here before we run out of time today. Commissioner Bowerly, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't often get to sit through all of the Property Tax Division hearings, so I appreciate the opportunity today to be with you.
There's no entrance fee, Commissioner.
I appreciate it.
No cover charge.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you just for a few minutes, and I will keep my testimony brief, Mr. Chairman. As this division report, we appreciate the opportunity to see it over the weekend. We all got some good reading in this weekend. Want to thank the committee for including the agricultural school bond credit. That's a provision that was in the governor's tax bill. Mr. Chairman, you've been carrying that conversation for a number of years. Representative Marquardt and I was in Worthington and in Moorhead earlier this year, and this really is an important issue, and so we appreciate the inclusion of that in the bill today. Unfortunately, we do not see a number of other priorities that were in the governor's tax bill that are also priorities across Minnesota, so I'd just like to spend a minute on those. Local government aids, as we've been discussing this morning, local governments provide essential services to people across Minnesota. increases in LGA, CPA, and ICWA aid were all included in the governor's budget, and we would hope that we could continue some of the conversation around how to make sure that we can continue to provide essential services and with the state aid to help reduce some of the pressure on property taxes at the local level. The governor also included additional money in the school debt service equalization aid to help ensure that we can build great schools for our kids across the state. Mr. Chair, we appreciate the ongoing conversations with you about the interaction between that provision and the school bond credit. We note that some of the changes that we had suggested and came from an OLA report on the Sustainable Forest Act initiative are not in the bill. The soccer stadium for the city of St. Paul, and then two provisions that deal with the buffer provisions that were enacted last year. Buffer aid compensation directly to the landowners who would be moving some of that into buffer, and then also importantly, we think for the local watershed districts who will be taking on some responsibilities with respect to those buffers, the governor had proposed some aid to those local jurisdictions. And we know that those local jurisdictions and counties, the watershed districts and counties, would prefer to, need to take on that responsibility. The other option is that Bowser would be taking on that responsibility. We also hear from those local jurisdictions that they do need additional funding to be able to do that. A couple of small but we think important changes. One is dealing with some changes for the senior property tax deferral program, lowering the occupancy requirements and changing the effective date for that would be an important change to help seniors stay in their homes and take advantage of that program. Mr. Chair and committee, just to flag a couple of additional issues that I'm sure we will be continuing to talk about as this bill moves forward. There, as the committee knows, are some potential constitutional issues with using legacy dollars to pay for PILT. We think there are questions as to whether that will provide general purpose aid to counties rather using legacy dollars to enhance land and water as that constitutional provision requires. We are still reviewing the report, but do want to note there are a number of issues from plastic bags to world fairs and rail lines to reverse referendum, to name a few, that create obstacles for providing tax relief for Minnesotans and exert state control over local decisions. Some of the, I think, most concerning aspects for us about the report deal with property tax refunds for individual Minnesotans, particularly relative to those that deal with businesses. We are concerned that the renter's tax changes are going to negatively impact people across Minnesota, particularly those in rural areas, and particularly seniors and people with disabilities who, as a share, take up a significant part of the recipients of the renter's credit. About 30% of the renter credit recipients are seniors and people with disabilities. And although in the first year there is an increase that shows an offset to the reduction that's happening over the long term, that is 1 year. And that's the same for the homeowners. So there's an increase for homeowners for 1 year only, but then over the long term, the renter's credit reflects a reduction. And, Mr. Chairman, we understand that the formula change that you're driving at, but the net result is a reduction in that benefit for people across Minnesota. And so while Minnesota renters are getting a cut and homeowners are getting only a one-year increase, the change to business property taxes reflect a substantial cut and are ongoing. For example, the CI levy changes. In the near term, this will allow all businesses to reduce their property taxes with the exclusion of the first $200,000. The freeze to the levy amount, however, over time, will disproportionately benefit large building owners like IDS and Mall of America. And it's important to note that the full impact of the freeze cannot be reflected in the window on the spreadsheet. So while removing the inflator costs about $12 million in 2018, in 5 years it will cost about $100 million by 2022, and by 10 years it will cost $250 million per year. So over the course of 10 years, the freeze will cost over $1.2 billion in a reduction of revenue. Particularly as we look at the state's significant uncertainty that was identified in the state's forecast and from federal policy changes that are unknown, we need to take a cautious approach to our budget outlook, including how we fit a tax bill into other priorities for our budget. And Mr. Chairman, as we move forward, we would like to continue the conversation about a couple of issues around implementation and perhaps some administrative costs that the Department of Revenue and other agencies may face in implementing the provisions in this bill. The governor and lieutenant governor are committed to sound budgeting that maintains Minnesota's fiscally responsible financial state. And we hope that we, as we continue a productive conversation about both the size of the tax bill and the priorities represented in it. We, too, hear from businesses that they would like a property tax cut. We also hear from businesses that they need better infrastructure to get their goods to market and a well-trained workforce into the future. In order to fund early ed, K-12, and higher ed to ensure a productive workforce in the short term and the long term, we need to invest resources. So as we move forward towards the full committee, Mr. Chairman, we look forward to addressing some of the technical issues and also continuing the conversation about the size of the tax bill relative to the rest of the budget. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Commissioner Bowerly. Members, any questions for Commissioner Bowerly? You left him speechless, Commissioner. Thank you.
Thank you for the time.
Thank you. Is there anyone who would like to testify just really briefly? You know, maybe we should take this point. I think we're going to recess. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think it'd be good for you to share with the committee members as well as the public sort of the plan going forward. I know the original agenda didn't talk about taking testimony on it, but we've heard rumors that you'd like to hear from other people about reactions to the report, and I assume there'll be some time for us to ask questions on at least the things that have changed from when we first heard those proposals. And I had also heard that you're thinking that we would mark up the bill on a non-standard committee time, and there's only two of us on our side who are on the full tax committee. If we take their time on Tuesday, there's other committees meeting at the same time. I suspect that is going to be true on your side as well, and it just seems kind of fair that those of us who have sat through 70, 80 bills, I don't know how many it is, it's a long list, have a chance to participate in the final discussions in shaping the report, and I'm wondering if Wednesday might be available for doing that since that's on everyone's schedule.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. I understand that we are going to be meeting tomorrow to mark up the bill. Was that been posted, Representative Loeffler?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe that's been posted, and what I have heard, though, is that you're proposing a time that this committee does not normally meet, and that's where I'm saying there are conflicts with other committees meeting at the same time. Mm-hmm. If we take over the full tax committee time, there are only two people on our side. There's just a couple on your side as well that are on full taxes. So for everyone else, they have obligations elsewhere as well.
I think it's kind of a busy time. We will do everything we can to accommodate people. We'll make certain that people have an opportunity to get here to vote on amendments and so forth. So we'll definitely accommodate folks the best we can. We're kind of under a tight deadline here to get moving to get this bill to the tax committee, I understand. So with that, we are meeting tonight. Okay. I think we're going to recess to the call of the chair around 5 p.m.
The same room?
200. In room 200. Okay. Has everybody got that? We're going to shoot for 5 o'clock in room 200. And we will, if there's any deviation from that time, we will let people know.
Is it 5?
Yeah. Is it 5 o'clock? Hold on just for a minute, members. We're going to double check on that.
It won't be before that, will it?
No. Okay. Yeah, we're just going to shoot for 5 o'clock at the call of the chair, and if it's later than that, we'll let you know. But so we're in recess until approximately 5 p.m. Members, I call the meeting of the House Property Tax and Local Government Finance Division back to order. We are going to proceed with testimony on the Property Tax Division report. First on the list that I have, and if there's anyone who's not on the list, feel free to either get on the list or feel free to come forward after we get through the list. The first is Mr. Liljenquist. Is he here?
Yes.
Welcome, Mr. Liljenquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Todd Liljenquist, and I represent the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. It's the trade association of rental property owners and managers. I'm here to testify on one provision, Article 2, Section 10. That is the renter's property tax refund, reformulating the rent constituting property taxes. When this bill was up last week, I indicated that many of our larger companies have national software that had to be reconfigured in order to formulate with the renter's credit in the first place. There aren't many states that have a similar program, so significant investment was made to do that. And having different rates in different geographic regions, I think for our members in many of these systems would be unworkable. And in most of the cases, they would have to manually re-input that amount. So, for example, in Minneapolis, they would have to put the 16.5 in, and St. Paul the 14, and in different geographic regions in the state. And we have many management companies that do operate in all of those given areas. So it will be a significant burden, which does add to the cost of doing business. We have a number of companies that all of January, they have staff members dedicated to getting the certificates of rent paid prepared and then out to renters, and that is a cost of business that they would have to bear. There are also, you know, the smaller and mid-sized owners who would also have to be re-educated on this, and those that do that manually would have to be made aware of it, and so there's an education effort that would have to be undertaken. I know when I had emailed the chair some of our concerns, he had asked for other options or other considerations that we might have, and the only thing I would say is one rate is our preferred approach, one rate statewide. The other approach, and I don't know if the department is here, and they will probably shoot me for saying this, but if there is going to be multiple rates, perhaps that be done at the department level, and that be figured out on their end rather than on the end of the business owners providing this.
Thank you. Members, questions for Mr. Liljenquist? Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Liljenquist, and I hope that your association supports the renter's credit because it does allow people to afford to stay in the properties that your members own. But I think that, you know, having four rates isn't all that difficult compared to, I suspect, all the different laundry charges that they have in every building and garage charges in every building, and every building is in a unique market, and it's hard for me to believe that the large, big, sophisticated members of your organization shouldn't be able to handle that. You know, while I do agree that maybe as the department goes to automating things, they might be able to do that, although it's provided by the landlord. So it could be that they have a form that once you enter in the county, which is one of the fields you have to put in, or the city or the property tax ID, that it would automatically fill to that point. So, I mean, I think there are some technology solutions that might be there. But like I say, I know that your members have different price points based on square footage, whether you've got the nice view or you've got the view of the garbage collection or the garages or whatever. And so I do think that for the interest of your tenants, that your members should be aware that this maybe isn't that much complexity for different numbers.
Thank you. Other questions, members? Is it Mr. Liljenquist or Liljenquist?
Liljenquist.
Okay.
Yes.
Representative Loeffler said it differently. I thought maybe hers was more nuanced
Sorry.
Than mine.
Doesn't matter.
So we got it either way. Thank you, Mr. Liljenquist.
Call me later.
Ms. Madden?
Good
Welcome, Ms. Madden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I brought Ms. Krznick with me on the same issue, if that's all right.
Oh, it is, perfectly, Ms. Krznick. So, Ms. Madden, do you want to go first?
Yes, I'll go first. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also have a letter from AARP. I know that got sent over a little late in the day, so we also brought it as a hard copy for the committee.
Okay, if you could introduce yourself, Ms. Madden, sure. That'd be great.
Thank you. My name is Nan Madden. I'm director of the Minnesota Budget Project. Just wanting to make a few comments with concerns about the cuts to the renter's credit in this division report. Division report takes a little different approach compared to the bill you looked at last week. For fiscal year 2019, the bill is essentially revenue neutral regarding the renter's credit as a whole. It makes about $40 million in cuts to one aspect of the renter's credit and then offsets that with an increase in other portions of the credit. But for 2020 onwards, this bill does cut the renter's credit by about $41 million a year. That's roughly an 18% cut. And I want to remind members of the committee who are the Minnesotans that receive the renter's credit. 70% have household incomes, roughly $31,000 or less. Statewide, 27% of renter's credit households include people over 65 or with serious disabilities. And that share does tend to be higher in greater Minnesota. So just want to express our concern that in a time when the state has budget surpluses, that Minnesota's lower-income renters collectively would lose more than $41 million a year in tax refunds. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity.
Thank you, Ms. Madden. Ms. Krznick, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Ann Krznick. I'm the Executive Director of the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition, which is made up of the Minnesota Catholic Conference, the Minnesota Council of Churches, the Jewish Community Relations Council, and the Islamic Center, representing approximately 80% of people of faith in Minnesota. On behalf of the faith community, I want to express concern about any reductions in the renter's credit. As you know, this provides property tax relief for low-income Minnesotans, and as Ms. Madden said, many of those being senior citizens and people with disabilities. A significant number of people receiving the credit are those that lost their homes during the housing crisis and are still in rental housing. In our churches and our faith communities, we see these families and individuals struggling. We see how every dollar makes a really significant difference, and this is a tool that's been very successful in allowing families to try to build assets as they want to work their way into the middle class, and in particular for those people with disabilities, for senior citizens on a fixed income, it's been a really wonderful tool to allow them to live in dignity on that income. So we really urge you not to make any reduction in the credit.
Thank you, Ms. Krznick. Members' questions for Ms. Madden or Ms. Krznick? Ms. Madden, Ms. Krznick, we do have for the 18-19 biennium, I think it is a slight increase for the renter's credit. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, I think you're right. Is it $1.8 million is the difference between the, sorry, let me back up, $42 million increase in one portion of the credit, $40 million cut from the other part, so it nets out to a little under $2 million.
Okay, thank you. Questions, members? All right, Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and while you do have the two figures that look like they kind of offset each other, by specific income and specific geography, they probably won't. Because people who are in a rural area where it's at 17% of rent equals property taxes for these purposes, being dropped to 14% is a significant adjustment. And even though the money that you add back is divided across all the income groupings that we have, we've been told that in greater Minnesota it's disproportionately seniors, it's disproportionately people with disabilities and lower income people, and so they may not see the benefit of the add-on because it's spread proportionally across all the income brackets the way you've designed it and as I understand it. So we're going to have some winners and we're going to have some losers, even though the percentage of rent that constitutes property taxes will be closer to what we know based on research from the Department of Revenue. The transition will be uneven for people experiencing this, and it would be difficult, I suspect, to model that because the Department of Revenue would have to sort out their data, which I don't think they have automated by county, but I'm not sure.
Thank you. Other questions or comments, members, on this section? Anything for Ms. Madden or Ms. Krisner? Thank you both.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Hall? Welcome, Mr. Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if it's okay, I'll have Jeff Van Wyken follow me.
That would be great if you'd please introduce yourself to the record, sir.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Max Hall, and I'm a legislative representative with AFSCME Council 5. Excuse me, Mr. Chair. We represent about 43,000 state, county, municipal employees throughout Minnesota. I'll make my comments relatively brief, but we did want to highlight two provisions that were included in the division report and one that was not. First of all, we would like to say that we respectfully do not support the inclusion of House File 484 and House File 211 in the division report, which makes changes to current law regarding the statewide business property tax. Revenue from this tax is deposited into the general fund, as you may know, and is used for much-needed public services in order to fund them adequately. Oftentimes, these necessary public services are underfunded, and so with House File 484 and 211, it dramatically reduces the amount of funds going to those necessary public programs. And then just lastly, Mr. Chair, we'd like to mention that we were disappointed to see that the local government aid and county program aid increases were not included in this division report. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I'll conclude and turn it over to Mr. Jeff Van Wyken.
Thank you, Mr. Hall. Mr. Van Wyken.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jeff Van Wyken. I am with the North Star Policy Institute. I would like to speak to the impact of removing the inflation adjustment from the state business property tax. Most of the tax relief resulting from this will accrue to high-value properties, with 1% of the business properties, but the highest values getting over 30% of the tax relief, and the 75% of properties with the lowest value getting about 14% of the relief. Taking into account the final incidence of the tax after shifting, 53% of the tax will be exported outside of Minnesota. Because so much of the relief is exported, the elimination of the inflator is an inefficient way to reduce Minnesota tax regressivity. Because the state business property tax is capped at the rate of inflation and is insulated from property tax growth and demographic from population growth and demographic changes that drive the need for state spending, it has grown less rapidly than other major state taxes since 2002. In fact, in real per capita dollars, it has declined by 13% over this period. You have been told that the state property tax should be treated like local property taxes, with a levy that is set each year based upon need rather than linked to the rate of inflation. That is not the message you were given back in 2005, when the legislature considered an increase to the state levy in response to a revenue shortfall. At the time, the business community told you to leave the state property tax alone. In truth, the state business levy is not treated like local levies. If it were, it would be much greater today than it is because it would not be insulated from the cost drivers that push local levies upwards. It is not treated like other state taxes with rates that are written into law. The 2017 state business property tax rate is approaching an all-time low, with businesses paying 20% less per dollar of value today than they were in 2002. Since 2002, the state business property tax has been a good deal for businesses and helps to explain why statewide business property taxes have increased much less rapidly than that of homeowners and that of most other owners of most other classes of property. In considering the need to eliminate the inflation adjustment, I would note that data from Ernst & Young, Minnesota's business effective tax rates, business taxes per private sector employee, and the business share of total state and local taxes are all below the national average. Thank you very much for your time, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to take questions.
Thank you, Mr. Van Wyken. Questions, members? Mr. Van Wyken or Mr. Hall? Thank you both.
Thank you. Thank you.
Ms. Cadoon. Good Welcome to Property Tax Committee again, Ms. Cadoon.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Beth Cadoon. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'm also here on part of the United for Jobs Coalition, which is a coalition of 80 organizations and local chambers across the state. So most of your local chambers would be part of this, as well as all the major business associations for the Minnesota Business Partnership, grocers, retailers. You could name all of them. And our number one priority was on business tax relief, specifically to reduce our high uncompetitive business property tax in the state, which unfortunately ranks amongst the highest in the nation, as I testified before, second highest in greater Minnesota, seventh highest in the metro, with national averages that aren't only a little above the national average, we're way above the national average and up to about 200% above our neighboring states in many types of business property tax. So I do want to thank you for your priority that you put on reducing this highly uncompetitive, regressive, fixed cost of doing business in the state. We certainly support that, and thank you for putting that in. We also thank you for including the repeal of the automatic inflator. We just believe, as for tax increases, that those are something that should really be discussed and debated and voted on by the legislature, not put on autopilot. So thank you for including that as well. The last item I did want to mention is we also thank you for including and we're supportive of the change on the workforce housing TIF provision that's in the bill. This is something that we've been hearing more and more about in greater Minnesota on that kind of impeding economic development in those areas. So thank you for including this TIF provision as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cadoon. Questions, members? Ms. Cadoon? Thank you. Mr. Carlson, G. Welcome back,
Mr. Chair, members. Thank you for clarifying which Carlson. Mr. Chair, members, I'd like to testify in support of a few things, in opposition to a few things, and then mention a few things that were omitted from the final bill. Number one, the ag containment fix that's included in Article 1, Section 3, the League of Cities supports that change that was authored by Representative Backer. We appreciate you including that in the bill. We support the technical fix to the LGA formula that was proposed by Representatives Mary Murphy, Representative Greg Davids, and Representative Gunther, and also the Murphy change that would retroactively increase the city, the 20 cities that had an LGA reduction in 2017 because of the error. We're not testifying specifically on the Oslo, Dundee, Jeffers, and Woodstock LGA fixes, but we appreciate you working with us. Those cities have now complied with their financial reporting requirements, and we appreciate the distribution of those past aids to those four cities. As Ms. Cadoon indicated, we've worked with the Chamber on the Workforce Housing TIF proposal. We strongly support that as an option and a tool for cities to deal with the lack of workforce housing within some of our communities in greater Minnesota, so we strongly support that. We support the TIF technical changes that were included in Representative Greg David's bill that were now included in the bill in Article 4. And then broadly, thank you for considering many of the city-specific TIF and sales tax proposals that were offered up. I think that many of those cities could not be here tonight, but I know many of them were thankful that you did include their provisions in the bill. Quickly, a couple of words of concern and opposition. The World's Fair offset to LGA, we oppose. The pretrial diversion offset, we oppose. Mr. Chair, I testified last Monday that those are significant changes in the philosophy of LGA, and we do oppose those offsets to the formula. We have major concerns still with the lease purchase reverse referendum provisions that were proposed by Representative Runbeck, although she did increase the reverse referendum threshold in that provision, but that's in Article 6, Section 5. We oppose the municipal fee restrictions language that you offered. We appreciate you working to try to moderate that language and narrow it. We still have concerns with the municipal fee restrictions in Article 7, Section 13. And then finally, the franchise fee reverse referendum piece of Representative Vogels. We appreciate him working with us to narrow that bill, but we still have major concerns with the necessity of having a reverse referendum requirement there. And then finally, Mr. Chair, pieces that were not in the final bill, Representative Lean and Representative Paul Anderson's LGA increases. We would still urge the committee to consider amendments to add back some of the LGA funding increase that were included in the Anderson-Lean bill. We do not have in this bill the construction sales tax exemption clarification that Representative Skwodzinski proposed. We do not have, RU did not include in the public finance article the simple majority for street reconstruction bond issue. I know you had concern about that, Representative Drozdowski. However, there is a reverse referendum requirement in current law, which is why we were suggesting reducing the unanimous vote to a majority vote, because the voters still have the reverse referendum threshold to rely upon. And then finally, a very minor issue, the bill does not include the September 30th levy certification date for special districts. We'd urge you to consider adding that. It was in House File 848 last year, and we would encourage you to add that to this bill as you move forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Members, questions for Mr. Carlson? Mr. Carlson, so if you were going to vote on this bill, you know, a lot of good stuff, things you're missing, you vote yay or nay?
Mr. Chair, I don't have an election certificate, to my best of my knowledge.
We don't say yay or nay, Mr. Carlson.
I will talk with you offline about that, Mr. Chair. But we do appreciate some of the good things you've added to the bill. We have major concerns with some of the other pieces. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Mr. May.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom May. I'm representing the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. First of all, we'd like to thank the chair for his inclusions in many of the things in the bill as it really help assessors and the work we do. There are a few things, although, that we do have issue with. First of all, we truly support Section 3, which solves the agricultural chemical containment issue that we've had for the last several years. We appreciate that and would like to move forward with that. We also support Section 12, which deals with the auxiliary structures on those lots leased for travel trailers. It increases the minimum from 1,000 to 10,000, and that will really help assessors in their workload. And I believe it will also help auditors in having to establish these property identifications for very small tax liability. We also strongly support Section 47, which is a bill that was introduced by Representative Whalen and sets up a legislative property tax reform working group. We're always keenly interested in the simplification of our property tax system, and MAO stands ready to work with that legislative group to accomplish great things. We also support veterans' benefits that are included in the bill. The only position that we would have that differs from the bill is we would hope that the veterans' benefit and exclusion would be a statewide program. A couple of the things that we don't agree with or have a little heartburn over, Section 17 is the overvalued property valuation appeals. We disagree with that language. Minnesota already has a very robust appeals process for taxpayers. We start out in the year of the valuation notice with an informal appeal. Any taxpayer who receives a valuation notice in a given year can appeal to their local assessor, talk to them informally about it. The next stop is the local board of equalization. If they don't like the answer at the local board, they go to the county board of equalization. If they still are not happy with that decision, they can file in Minnesota tax court, and they can do that up until April 30th of the following year. So they have a full year after their valuation notice to determine that their value is not correct and file in tax court. Assessors also have the abatement method to deal with properties that possibly have a valuation error or they need to be corrected. In this regard, the bill would provide all taxpayers with an automatic two-year kind of adjustment. If the boards were to reduce the value, if the tax court was to reduce the value, or if an abatement were to reduce the value or adjust the value, they would automatically have the ability to file in tax court, even though the date of April 30th could be passed already. We think it adds a lot of complexity, and we would hope that it doesn't chill decisions made by assessors to correct property valuations when it's an automatic two-year appeal. We also have an issue with Section 49. It's the repealer, and this section repeals the requirement that was passed in 2013 for assessors who value property to have the accredited Minnesota assessor designation. Since 2013, MAO has restructured our whole education system. We've worked on making sure that every assessor has support from the association and our education program to meet these requirements. So far, we've already had many of our members meet those requirements that were required in 2013. We would oppose the full repeal of this requirement, and we would support House File 1431 and Senate File 1495 that are a compromise bill that we worked with the Department of Revenue and with the Association of Minnesota Counties. And it adds some additional time, and it also provides for a waiver for those assessors who prefer not to meet the requirements of AMA. With that, I would answer any questions you might have.
Questions for Mr. May? Seeing none, thank you so much, Mr. May.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Hilgard. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Members, my name is Matt Hilgarts. I represent the Association of Minnesota Counties. Association of Minnesota Counties represents all of Minnesota's 87 counties. Similar to Mr. Carlson, I'm going to talk about a few things that we're very supportive of, a few things that we have concerns, and then I'll linger on one issue. I'm assuming Representative Dezkoff can guess what that will be, and that will be a county program aid, which has been our number one priority this session. We are very thankful for the A containment language that's included in this bill for the clarification purposes of our assessors and our property tax bases in our communities. I want to thank Chair Drazkowski for his work on the PILT sustainability measure that is incorporated in this bill. That is, I think, 2 or 3 years coming. That's been a lot of hard work, and we appreciate your persistence in pushing that through. We also want to thank Representative Anderson for his tax forfeiture language and cleanup language that's also included in the bill. We have concerns about the provision in this bill that was most recently heard, I think just last week, on the SWCD levy line items. We do believe that this is not necessary, that this is only a couple or a few cases of disagreement between county boards and SWCDs, and that these are better negotiated and discussed outside of the parameters of special legislation. We also would just forewarn committee members that this might be a pathway towards levy certification authority in the future, and that does have some of our commissioners concerned. The overvaluation credit was mentioned earlier, so I won't get into details on that. And I would like to focus the remainder of my testimony on what, from our perspective, is the largest omission, which is the omission of county program aid formula and funding. You've heard a lot this session from us on the increasing amount of mandates that your counties have to deal with and their reliance on the property tax system. Not necessarily fees, not assessment, but the property tax system. You've also heard from a lot of people, commissioners, staff, AMC folks, about the broken formula. Half of our counties have lost, more than half of our counties have lost aid since 2005, and that's not accounting for inflation. And more than 25 counties at one time or another fell off the formula, which means they failed to receive half of what the formula is supposed to be allocating. We've heard tragic stories where one county has lost 88% of its aid since 2005. And while we've seen or heard heard a lot of legislation inferring local governments aren't doing a good job of keeping their costs intact. You've also heard testimony stating the opposite, stating just how frugal and bare bones these counties have been, how innovative they've been in budgeting during these times of no CPA increases. Last week you heard from Lacqua-Paul Commissioner Todd Patzer, who stated, who came here from Lacqua-Paul and said, we do literally what is asked of us, nothing more. We're not building buildings, we're not hiring new staff, but we're having a very difficult time keeping up with these mandates. And on top of that, our CPA has fallen over 80%. You also heard from Stevens County, where they would say if their levy, if they had their CPA from years past, that'd be 10 percentage points on their levy. That is a real difference. That's a real story. And so, in all honesty, I just want to end by saying, not to be too dramatic here, but that we appreciate the support that this committee has given on both sides of the aisle. That CPA bill had over 35 authors, close to half the committee chairs, very bipartisan. It has 87 board resolutions of support that we've worked for 3 years in getting. It was very meaningful discussions. It represents all of your elected commissioners. And so we're hopeful that as this discussion continues, that this committee will look towards CPA not as some giveaway to counties, but as part of the property tax relief equation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Hilgart. Members, questions for Mr. Hilgart? Mr. Hilgart, I did pass around, I don't know if you and I had this discussion in the past, but I passed around on an outline of the sales tax exemptions that counties and cities, and I guess this would be for Mr. Carlson too, but we have passed over the last several years a series of reductions in sales taxes for local governments, and this is one thing I don't think gets acknowledged very well, but if you look on here, for instance, right now, cities are getting exempted on an annual basis $86 million in sales taxes. Counties, $65 million in sales taxes. And so the legislature has done some work to provide relief. And if the argument is that CPA and LGA provide tax relief, lifting this mandate of sales taxes also provided tax relief. If that's the case, the question would be, of course, what happened with that relief? And it just seems that maybe that doesn't get acknowledged real often. So I wanted to share that with people as we look at that. Those numbers actually dwarf the numbers that you are asking for additional support from the Minnesota taxpayers. So I don't know if anybody has any comments or questions on that, but we also have to remember we have done some things here, and I think I know a number of other members have written bills to lift some of the exemptions, and we have to stop extending more and more more and more mandates to you. I guess the discussion is and can and should be more than just what additional LGA or CPA that can be provided. Mr. Hilgart.
Mr. Chair, and that's a very valid point. I should thank you, first of all, for those sales tax exceptions, because you're right, they pass on cost savings to your constituents, property taxpayers. In those time periods, though, we've also seen an increase in mandates. And right now, as it's written, too, we have a new buffer mandate that is currently unfunded. I don't see the proposals or any tax proposal that includes buffer aid funding. But counties are dealing with unfunded mandates, and we don't have an option on whether or not to pay it. Today, I found out about a new mandate that we have, and that's covering the cost of funeral costs for people who can't afford it. That's something that the state said to counties you should do. And in Crow Wing County, it was $230,000 last year. That's not an option they have as a county board. That's something that the state said a long time back that you need to cover those costs. And so counties have been that catch-all of that safety net for the state. And I think what you're hearing and seeing from commissioners coming from rural parts of the state, parts of the state where their motto is not one penny more than what we're obligated to spend, is that they are at capacity. But I do appreciate your commentary on the sales tax piece, and I do appreciate what the state has given past years. And if $25 million is three times less than what the sales tax is, I think that's a pretty good deal.
I thought it was additive, Mr. Hilgart. Thank you. Members, any other questions for Mr. Hilgart? Thank you, sir. Anyone else would like to testify on the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Patricia Naumann, I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities, representing cities in the 7-county metropolitan area. Some of my comments will echo what Mr. Gary Carlson said previously. Not to wade back into the local government aid discussion, but Metro Cities does support increases to the local government aid program and hopes that the committee will reconsider increasing the LGA formula. I was thinking back to 2013 when the city organizations came together and worked with legislators to vet the formula and come up with a new formula and distribution that does rely on sufficiency in revenues and adequacy in those revenues, and so the increase, we would just appreciate a reconsideration of an increase. On the LGA front also, Metro Cities does not support using the offsets or reducing local government aid based on factors that have no nexus with the local government aid formula. Those are of great concern to the organization. We believe that offsetting LGA for those reasons does undermine the integrity and structure of the LGA program. Metro Cities does support the state's direct property tax relief programs and supports the increase to the homestead credit refund program contained in the article. A few other provisions that we do have concerns with have to do with the prohibition on fees and taxes associated with plastic bag bans in invalidating local ordinances for those. We believe that that's an issue that falls under the purview of something that should be at the discretion of local officials. Metro Cities also would continue to express concern with the franchise fee provision in the bill. We do appreciate the work that has been done with the author of that bill to make it a little less onerous for local governments, but we still continue to not see a need for that legislation. In addition, Metro Cities does have concerns with the lease purchase reverse referendum that Mr. Collison had referenced, as well as the limits on municipal fees. And finally, we do support the changes in the bill to the tax increment financing provisions, the technical and minor changes that make it more flexible for cities. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Ms. Naumann. Questions for Ms. Naumann? Okay, Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bradley Peterson here today on behalf of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. I'd like to start by noting the things that recommend this division article. Those would be the numerous provisions for individual local governments that have been noted, the TIF changes, the local option sales taxes, and the like. Also, the workforce housing TIF provision that was noted that's an especially keen issue in Greater Minnesota. So those are the good things. Also included in the list of good things would be the fix for the glitch on the LGA formula to several small cities that were carried in the Murphy and Gunther bills. We very much appreciate those changes as well. Obviously, our biggest object of concern and disappointment is the lack of the local government aid increase in the context of a $1.65 billion surplus. We feel that there certainly would be room to get us back to the 2002 level in local government aid. And we especially contrast this actually with the increase in the Homestead Credit Refund, a program that has skyrocketed since the early 2000s by over 400%, while local government aid has languished at minus 8% since 2002. And so, Mr. Chair, we think that as this moves forward, we'd like to see more balance between those two programs. The Homestead Credit Refund tends to skew metro. Local government aid tends to skew rural, and so we feel that those are important in balancing each other out. And we look forward to working with you and the full tax committee and all of the legislature moving forward to make sure that that gets done. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Questions for Mr. Peterson, members? Okay. Thank you. Mr. Sulem.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ken Sulem with the Minnesota Association of Townships. I will be very brief, just highlighting three sections of the bill that we are in support of. There's a couple of sections that we're grateful are not in the bill, but if I mention those, you might want to add them, so I'll leave that out. The first one is Article 1, Section 1, the very first start of the bill, allowing the use of Wi-Fi materials on agricultural lands, preserve lands. We were unaware that this prohibition was there before this session began, and of course one of our key efforts is to try to get high-speed internet broadband access to all parts of the state. And so anything we can do to make that easier, and this is one step where the farmers need the access to this type of service, is something that we're very grateful for. So thank you very much for putting that in. I have to slightly differ from our friends at the assessors that we do support Article 1, Section 49. We agree that the compromise has some good provisions, but we had always stated that our preference was the language that's in the bill. And finally, we are very grateful for the inclusion of Article 3, the PILP program efforts dealing with the legacy acquisitions. You heard this afternoon from the commissioner indicating the governor has concerns about the constitutionality of this provision. As we have stated many times and over the many years this bill has been moving forward, we are firmly in firm belief that this provision is, in fact, constitutional, that has been carefully crafted and tailored to meet the needs of the constitutional language with both the amendment and the way the courts have ruled on previous actions. It is a very important step as we have more and more lands coming off the tax rolls and local governments be held harmless in that acquisition. The commissioner testified that the governor's preference is the county program aid. We absolutely fully support our county friends and their need for CPA, but that's the governor's request, and I sure hope he has an idea for the townships, because without it, we don't receive county program aid. The PILT is a crucial part of our funding for those areas. And so with that, I'll stand for any questions.
Questions for Mr. Sulem? Thank you, Mr. Sulem. Mr. Carlson Kay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association that consists of 10 of the greater Minnesota regional center counties and 4 counties here in the metropolitan area. I want to start by acknowledging and thanking the chair and the other members who brought forward provisions, including the school bond agricultural property tax credit, the agricultural containment facility exemption modification, the expansion of the definition of agricultural purposes for purposes of the classification law to include local conservation programs as well as state and federal programs, the special property tax abatement for Aiken, Crow Wing, and Mille Lacs counties, the increase in the PILT payment of 50 cents per acre for certain acquired land, although I do have to note that that's only a 2-year provision and we would be hopeful that would be made permanent. Also thankful for the provisions that subject land transfers to county subdivision ordinances as well as cities and the chair's PILT trust fund provision. Do also want to thank the chair for inclusion of the numerous tax forfeited land sales. Hopefully this will help in making it easier to get those properties back on the tax rolls. I do want to also mention, though, there are a number of concerns of what's missing. We'll point out first that last year's veto tax bill had over $36 million for counties, including for Indian Child Welfare Act, out-of-home placement, riparian aid for those counties electing to accept jurisdiction for the buffer law. All of those are missing, and I'll come back to the last one. The property tax refund provision for overvalued property that Mr. May has already highlighted. Again, under our current law, there are multiple opportunities for individuals to appeal the values of their property. The boards of equalization at both the city or township level as well as the county level, tax court and abatements. This provision is basically providing an out for people who failed to take advantage of these many opportunities to appeal their property's values. Also want to echo the concern of Mr. Gary Carlson regarding the reverse referendum provision on debt that is issued by HRAs, EDAs, or port authorities to finance certain municipal or county buildings. As I've testified in previous committees, the facilities that counties have built with these, jails and county courthouses, don't enjoy widespread support. And consequently, we need the flexibility that's provided by the current law to build these facilities that we're mandated to provide by state law. A thing that has not received mention so far is the repeal of performance aid, something that Representative Marquardt put in the statute several years ago to encourage the adoption of performance measures. This bill repeals that. I'll finally, although I don't represent them, I do want to note the repeal of the Hennepin County library aid. This was put into the law to facilitate the county's takeover of the Minneapolis library system, and I would concur with probably their sentiments that this is unfair to change the rules of the game on them when they basically took over the substantial financial commitment to maintain the access to these facilities. And I'll conclude, be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Questions for Mr. Carlson? One quick one, Mr. Carlson. The containment facility language, have you looked at that, and do you, what's your, is it rock solid?
Mr. Chairman, last year's bill that simply repealed the exemption is, in my opinion, a better alternative, but this has been the subject of multiple discussions between the assessors, Mr. Gary Carlson, and representatives of the industry. I support the compromise that is reflected in the bill.
Thank you. Members, other questions? Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Ms. Kelleher.
Good evening, members. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. We represent every school district in the state through their elected boards. And, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to start off with the rock star of the bill, at least for school districts around the state, and that is the School Building Bond Ag Credit. I know this is something you have passion for, as well as Representative Marquardt. And your school districts, thank you. Over the last 3 years, we have seen a tremendous drop-off of rural capital bond issues fail in outstate Minnesota because this had been on the line so long. There really started to be a dichotomy between our what our metro students could have available as well as our rural students. Now, it doesn't give another dollar to a school district. It just gives them a fair shot to ask their public and lets their farmers become the education supporters I know they want to be. So I can't thank you enough for that. That will change a lot of education issues from around the state. I do have a little bit of concern about debt service equalization. It's not reflected in this bill, but we oftentimes think of that's another way to level tax effort from around the state. We do have some concerns, and I'll leave this in your hands more than my education realm, but back in 2002, we came up with a method for the general state levy, and in that, part of that three-way, four-way, six-way deal that we came up with had to do with exempting cabins and ag land from a certain portion of school referendums. They were the general referendum market value, first tier, second tier, and third tier. They were the local optional revenue, the equity revenue, transition revenue, and the first tier board approved referendum. They are all based on that counties and ag lands are not taxed. The rest of all the school referendums have a net tax capacity. So we just ask you to watch those as you go forward and some of those impacts that you might not see when looking just directly at the property taxes. School districts are not all funded on the same formula. There's a lot of dueling pieces here. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll finish my testimony and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Kelleher. Questions for Ms. Kelleher members? Thank you, Ms. Kelleher, and thank you for your help and discussion. I know Representative Marquardt and I continue to push forward the idea of getting to that tax-based change to house, garage, and acres. As a matter of fact, members, we have the bill ready, and we don't know where it's going to go this session, or maybe it won't go anywhere, but we want to keep the discussion going regardless of where it can go. If anybody else wants to sign on to it, there it is. And that takes it, as Representative Marquardt, I think, has coined really well, this idea that we have in the bill of writing down 50% of the cost of ag school construction levies by 50% is really step one, because realizing people in town pay one-tenth of what the people on the farm pay for construction levies. This writes it down halfway, but they're still at five times as much instead of ten times as much, so we still have that issue. And Representative Marquardt has said it really well, that this can, and we are both hopeful it will be step two at some point in the future in the legislative process. So anyway, take a look at that bill, and we're out promoting whenever we can. Thank you. Anyone else would like to testify? Okay. Nobody. Members, anybody, and members have any questions for staff or each other, authors, or as my old ag engineering professor said, let's cuss and discuss this issue. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, we just had a really quick walkthrough this morning. But we did notice a couple of things had changed from the bills as they were presented from the committee. And maybe we could ask staff to explain at least a couple of those that weren't immediately obvious to me and maybe to others. And there was one that had to do with, for the, I believe it was originally the city of Maple Grove, and how it would handle the state general levy. It's defined by its fiscal disparities contribution. The number of it seemed to increase dramatically. And if we could just get some more background on that, that would be helpful.
Mr. Hines, can you help with that one?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, the provision you're referencing is actually a provision for the city of Rogers rather than Maple Grove. And this is the same provision that ended up in House File 848 in 2015 or 2016 or both, or 2015. So the original bill sought to give relief to cities that had their own water systems, water and sewer systems, excuse me. And this provision instead looks at cities that are outside the metropolitan transit area, but then it looks to ones that are both that are outside that area and are also making a very high contribution to the fiscal disparities program relative to their total tax base, and gives them relief if they're over 8% of tax capacity being contributed, but it does it by giving them relief through the state through a reduction in the state general levy payment rather than actually affecting the fiscal disparities program. So it really keeps the fiscal disparities program intact, but it does recognize their heavy contribution and their lack of being sort of fully in the metro area in that way. And the cost we're getting is about $740,000 per year, I believe.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hines, and has this funding mechanism using the state general levy ever been used before that you're aware of? And for what purpose or what to address what issue?
Mr. Hines, the innovative approach to this particular provision.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, this is pretty unique in terms of a feature. There's no other no other deviations from the standard state general levy of just everybody paying the state rate, paying into the state general fund. So this is a unique feature.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I assume this only benefits the one city as it's defined.
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, there's actually two other places that benefit, but they're very small amounts. The city of Coates in Dakota County and a township called Louisville Township in Scott County. But they're less than $10,000 each. So now, of course, we don't know who might be out there near the edge of getting qualifying at some point in the future, or those would drop off. But for now, it's just those three.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think that, like we've learned on any precedent in this committee, that it tends to spawn other local bills. And we've got quite a few local bills of this bill already. So I think we need to ponder this one.
Okay, thank you. Other questions or thoughts? None. Well, members, we're scheduled for tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. in this room. We're in room 200 in the same room again. Anyone else have any parting thoughts? Okay, and we'll and I've mentioned to Lead Loeffler that if we get to the point, I know there's members that may have amendments, and if we run into problems with time for drafting those, and we just don't have time, we will make time and we'll recess or whatever it takes so everybody's ideas are heard. So with that, we will reconvene tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock back here, and we'll let the meetings adjourn.